Good Wednesday to you. Thanks so much for tuning in to another edition of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by our friends at Nosler. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Cam Edwards coming to you today once again from the site of the 2016 vice presidential debate and a mixed martial arts extravaganza coming to Farmville, Virginia in October of this year. We've got a fantastic program for you today on the show. Joy Pullman of the Federalist. We talked with Joy last week about the vote among students at Stanford University to restore I think it was a two-quarter course. It was basically a one-semester course on Western civilization. This was, up until the 80s, a required course at Stanford. And then students said, we don't want to learn about this stuff. And back in the 80s, because every generation of college students has its own thing to protest about, they got Western Civ removed. So there were students who wanted to hold a vote among the students to see if there was interest in restoring Western Civ. The students who were organizing the vote got grief for this. Students who actually signed saying, yeah, let's have a vote, were told, we're keeping track of who you are. If you ever run for office, we're going to bring this up. Well, they did get enough signatures to have that vote. The vote was held last Thursday and Friday. The results, not good for Western civilization. I'm sorry, I wish that I could report some heartwarming ending to the story. No, the vote was very lopsided, about 6-1, opposed to the idea of bringing back a required course in Western civilization. So we'll talk about it with Joy Pullman of the Federalist later on in the hour. John Nelson from USA High School Clay Target League. He's the vice president there. Now, this actually is a heartwarming story. Provides a little bit of hope. Around the country, we are seeing phenomenal growth in the shooting sports at the high school level. Minnesota has really been leading the way on this. We've been talking about this every spring for the past couple of years, watching the state high school trap shooting championship just grow by leaps and bounds. So they're talking now about 10,000 students across the state of Minnesota who are going to be competing at the high school level. They're in the trap league. This is a state-sanctioned high school sport. 10,000 students there in Minnesota. And the good news is apparently we are starting to see this kind of growth in other states around the country as well. In hour two, we're going to chat with our friend David Webb, host of The David Webb Show on Sirius XM Patriot 125, about Bill de Blasio's growing scandals, big and large, everything from the big and small, I should say, big and large, everything from the skit involving Hillary Clinton. And by the way, wasn't that a bold display of leadership? Hillary Clinton getting grief for this skit in which she and Bill de Blasio joke about being on CP time, which I got to tell you, first time I heard them use that phrase, I thought they were talking about Communist Party time. But no, apparently that refers to colored people time. And it's okay for Bill de Blasio and Hillary Clinton to joke about this because, you know, come on, they've got a D after their name, right? So who's going to really ding them hard for something like this? Well, Hillary's been getting some questions, I guess. Not a lot of grief, mind you, just some questions. And Hillary Clinton, who wants to be the commander-in-chief, wants to be the president of the United States, said the buck in this situation stops somewhere over there right by Bill de Blasio because it was really his skit. You know, she was just playing along here. She didn't really know anything about it. I mean, it was pure Hillary, honestly. But we'll talk about that and more with David Webb next hour. Also, it's an hour of Dave Workman, the Seattle Gun Rights Examiner, going to join us as well. Taking a look at Seattle's gun tax. Remember, $25 for every firearm sold in the city of Seattle. 5 cents tax on every round of ammunition. It's a little bit less for a .22 long rifle. I think it's 2 cents a round. How's that working out for Seattle? The money raised by this is supposed to go towards gun violence education efforts, whatever that means. It looks like what's happening is that this is actually driving retail out of Seattle, which pretty much anybody could have told you. But we're seeing a lot of these kind of bad economic proposals, but bad for the economy, good for virtue signaling. not just in Seattle, but around the country as well. In California, I think with that $15 an hour minimum wage increase, where Governor Jay Brown even acknowledged, you know, this might not be great for the economy, but it's good for the soul. I think I'm paraphrasing a little bit. Tim Lee with the Center for Individual Freedom joining us in Hour 3. Stephen Cruiser of PJ Media. We also have the hero of the day, the deal of the day, good guy of the day. Howard Stern talking about the Second Amendment. I guess there are a lot of people who must not listen to Howard Stern who were surprised by this, because I've seen a number of liberal Howard Stern supports the Second Amendment. This is not a new position for Howard Stern. But he once again was talking about why he believes it's important to protect the right to keep and bear arms. We'll share that with you coming up next hour as well. Speaking of celebrities and their viewpoints, Bono testifying on Capitol Hill yesterday. Did you ever think, I mean, think back to when U2 first made it big, if you're old enough to think way back when. Can you imagine, like, thinking back then that someone like Bono would have been, I mean, like, he was up there with Billy Idol or Flock of Seagulls, neither of whom I think made it to testify before Congress. But Bono did yesterday, talking about, because this is, you know, of course, what Bono was an expert on, how to defeat ISIS. Specifically, the causes and consequences of violent extremism and the role of foreign assistance. And the foreign assistance part is what Bono is really talking about, the need to provide more foreign assistance. But one of the things that he had talked about, he said, quote, in terms of fighting ISIS, I think comedy should be deployed. Mm-hmm. The first people that Adolf Hitler threw out of Germany were the Dadaists and the Surrealists. It's like you speak violence, you speak their language, but you laugh at them when they're goose-stepping down the street and it takes away their power. So I'm suggesting that the Senate send in Amy Schumer and Chris Rock and Sacha Baron Cohen. Thank you. Well, it's been about 24 hours now. I haven't seen any news stories about Amy Schumer, Chris Rock, or Sacha Baron Cohen volunteering. So I don't know if Bono is in favor of the drafting of celebrities. If you say the Senate should send in these individuals, do we need to bring back the draft, but only for Hollywood, only for creative types? I might be able to get on board with this idea. Draft the celebrities and send them to Syria and Iraq to fight ISIS with comedy? If I didn't actually, on some level, not want to see the humanitarian disaster that would ensue, and I wouldn't want to see that humanitarian disaster, I'd be all for this idea. But you know, and I know, that if celebrities like Amy Schumer, Sacha Baron Cohen, Chris Rock, whoever you want to send over there, whoever your designated funny person is, if they're going to Iraq or Syria, they're going with a bunch of our military who will be armed. And they're going to be going to entertain the troops. Because you and I know that celebrities, look, they love to sit safely in Hollywood and I guess they would say speak truth to power. Remember The Interview? That movie with Seth Rogen and James Franco a few years ago, making fun of the North Koreans, and then we had the Sony Pictures hack and everything. And they love to do that. But you probably have to go back to World War II to find a Hollywood culture that, as an industry, actively fought for this country and used the industry to fight for this country. Generally speaking, you know, they're not going to take up that challenge. It's still going to be, despite the protests of Bono, it is still going to be the men and women of our military. You've got Marines who are setting up fire bases in Iraq. You've got special forces who are working in places that we don't even know about. doing things that we will likely never learn about. And those are the men and women who, frankly, are going to continue to take the fight to ISIS. Besides, I think Amy Schumer is too busy pushing for gun control right now. But Bono, with his bright ideas on Capitol Hill yesterday. Now, also throughout the afternoon here on NRA News Cam and Company, we will be taking a look at the latest legislative news. We have no updates for you out of Georgia. I do want to start there, as we will continue to do over the next couple of weeks. We have until early May for Governor Nathan Deal to either sign or veto the campus carry legislation. He has not done either yet. So, again, if you are a gun owner in Georgia, make sure that you are continuing to contact the governor's office down there, whether it's email, the phone call, but make sure that the governor's office continues to hear from you. In addition to the campus carry bill, which is a House Bill 859 in Georgia, you also have the omnibus gun bill that is on Governor Nathan Deal's desk as well. And both of those bills, again, could become law if they are not vetoed by Governor Deal. But we have a few weeks to go before that deadline arrives. Meanwhile, in the state of Delaware, you've got a bill. This is similar to other bills that we've seen introduced around the country, both at the state level and at the federal level. It's one of those bills that purports to be a bill that is about the protection of elephants and rhinos and the ivory-bearing animals out there. The problem with this bill is that it doesn't actually address the issue of poaching, because that doesn't really happen here in the United States. So this bill in Delaware, it's Senate Bill 156, the sale, purchase, and possession with intent to sell of any ivory or rhinoceros horn is prohibited. Just blanketed prohibited. Including antique items, documented antiques and certain musical instruments. Otherwise, it would be a misdemeanor for you to sell the item for another person to buy it. This even goes beyond the federal legislation that we have seen here. This is scheduled to come up for a vote in the Senate in Delaware on Thursday, April 14th. That would be tomorrow. So if you are a Delaware resident, and keep an eye on your legislature as well, even if you're not a resident of Delaware, because, again, we're seeing these types of bills pop up really all around the country. And if your legislature has not dealt with a bill like this this year, it is likely that they will before long. All right, one more story before we head to break here. Rasmussen. You know, we haven't talked a lot about polls lately, and that's because there are some real issues in the polling industry right now. And I think, you know, look, if you are a regular listener to this program, you've heard me say for years, take a poll with a grain of salt, or three or four. A poll is not a perfect snapshot. The problem is, pollsters are having an even harder time trying to bring their lens into focus. Sometimes they get a great picture. Other times it's just completely fuzzy. And it's hard for us to know when the right, when the wrong, particularly when we're not exactly, we're not talking about, you know, candidates or elections where we can see, all right, how do these, you know, pre-election polls compare to what the final vote was? But with that gigantic caveat in mind, I still thought this was pretty interesting from Rasmussen. They asked a number of questions about gun ownership. What they found was that nearly one in four Americans, according to their poll, say that either they or somebody in their immediate family has bought a gun in the past year. One in four, well, 23%. 70% have not, 6% were not sure. 63% of Americans with a gun in their home, Rasmussen found, feel safer because someone in that home owns a firearm. Rasmussen said 44% of Americans think that it is too easy to buy a gun in this country. 11% say that it is too hard. 36% consider the level of difficulty about right. Now, again, think about that. 44% of Americans, so not 50%. This despite Michael Bloomberg for going on a decade now. I mean, going back to the formation of Mayors Against Illegal Guns. Spending, I don't know how many tens of billions, I'm sure in the hundreds of millions of dollars at this point, trying to get his anti-gun legislation, but his anti-gun message out there. And you know what? He has gotten his message out there in a variety of forms. Mayors, celebrities, moms, politicians, occasionally even the mayor himself. I mean, he's gotten his message out there. What he hasn't been able to do is actually get his message to stick. Again, support for more gun control laws, not a big priority for most Americans. Depending on what poll you look at, and again, I know that you could look at another poll that would show, a majority of Americans do want to have more gun control laws. But it doesn't seem like the needle has really moved culturally. Again, we're seeing another big renewed push right now, because this is, again, one of the ways that Hillary Clinton wants to try to differentiate herself from Bernie Sanders. And Michael Bloomberg has been saying for quite some time now, two candidates, this is the year to run on gun control. Now, when a billionaire who is, you know, thinking about spending $1 billion of his own money on his own presidential race, and then decided, nah, I'm not going to get in. When he tells candidates, hey, I'm watching those who are going to be talking about gun control. Yeah, you better believe a lot of these candidates are going to decide that this really is the year to run on gun control. So we're seeing a big political push. We are seeing a big cultural push. But again, we're not seeing the needle move. As a matter of fact, what we are seeing are more Americans purchasing firearms, record number of NICS checks being performed month after month, concealed carry courses that are full. I was at lunch earlier today talking with a waitress who's 22 years old, college student, and is taking her concealed carry course in May. I just came up out of the blue. We were chatting about something, guns came up, and she said, oh, yeah, no, I have two, and I'm taking my concealed carry course. You know, again, the anti-gun advocates, by the way, Cosmo, I'm sure, is horrified to hear that. They'll be happy to know, though, I did not gunsplain at all. I actually just listened. The anti-gun advocates don't want to acknowledge that this is happening. They want to, again, try to create this narrative that huge numbers of Americans are demanding these anti-gun moves. You see, no, huge numbers of Americans are applying for their concealed carry license. That's what's actually happening. All right, we're going to take a quick time out. When we return to the program here, Joy Pullman writing at the Federalist with an update on what's going on in Stanford. Bad news for the future of Western civilization. I don't think that's hyping things too much, actually. Stick around. We've got more NRA News, Cam & Company, coming up right after this.
Speaking with Bill Poole, he is Managing Director, NRA Education and Training Division. Bill, let's talk about the NRA Basics of Pistol Shooting course. I understand some of it's now available online. Tell us about it.
Yes, John. It's called Blended Learning. That means that part of the course is online. It's about a 7.5-hour online training section that students can complete in the comforts of their own home on their own schedule. And then once they've completed the online or the e-learning module, then they can contact an NRA-certified instructor who will take them to the range and check out their skills, make sure their safe gun handling is at its top, and that their marksmanship skills are just as good as it needs to be.
So this is the NRA Basics of Pistol Shooting course, which is, Bill, such a great course and such a great thing. You guys have kind of jiggered things up a little bit there to make it easier for people to do, right?
It is. is easier, but I don't want anybody to think that that means that it's shorter or less comprehensive. It's about 7.5 hours of seat time when you take the e-learning module, and then about another 5 hours of time when you go shooting. But the good news is the shooting portion can be all done in one day, in half a day, and so it's going to meet the needs of our students' schedules much better than we've been able to do in the past.
I love it. So then get the book learning part done, then get out there to the range with an NRA-certified instructor and finish it all up. It's a great idea, this blended learning course. So, Bill, how can folks get more information about this? How can they sign up? How do they do it?
First step is go to our webpage. It's onlinetraining.nra.org, and I hope they all do it today.
Why should folks check out the NRA Basics of Pistol Shooting course?
It is one of the most vibrant, robust e-learning training courses they're ever going to encounter. There's video, there's 3D pictures. You can listen to it. You can read it. I mean, we've used every modality teachers know how to use. It's an excellent course.
Could have said it better myself, Bill Pohl. Thank you so much, sir.
Talk with a friend, Benny Spies, again from Gunner with Benny Spies. Hopefully the audience has watched the program. If not,
if you have it, you should.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, it really is a fun show, and that's what I like about it, is that it's not your... It's not, you know, 2 minutes in.
No, we do a lot.
We've got to, you know, when's the dead deer coming? As you say, it really is personality driven.
Yep.
You are, you're quite the personality.
There's a lot of moving parts. We do a lot of different things. We drive around that old Winnebago, the Toaster 73, or the old Chevelle 65. It's a secret weapon. You know, we got the new boat, the Aluma Craft, the Willie Nelson. You know, there's a lot of moving parts, and we have a lot of fun.
Why is the boat called the Willie Nelson?
Because my old man, when I was a kid, would take me fishing or whatever, wherever we were going, hunting or fishing. He had one tape, and it was stuck into the cassette tape in the pickup, and it was always On the Road Again. It's the only song that I ever, my first favorite song, so I dedicated the boat to Willie Nelson.
That's pretty awesome.
Yeah, that's the truth.
Does the Chevelle have a name?
The Chevelle's a secret weapon, yeah.
It's just a secret weapon.
It's not running right now. Nothing of mine runs.
No?
No, the boat does, but nothing of mine runs.
Do you actually, like, tow the toaster?
Yeah, it's
around
the,
from the
toaster
to place?
Be better off on fire.
But it's iconic.
It is iconic.
You can't. You'll never be able to get rid of that thing.
I hope I don't have to. So I hope I can keep doing this. You know, where I go, the toaster goes.
Right.
That's the plan.
So you're saying that you don't want to show up here 1 year and be like, instead of the toaster, you've got the bread oven, which is like the 80-foot long concert tour bus.
Well, that means we've upgraded a little bit.
Yeah.
But I still want it to be in the 70s. You know, we need the shag carpet. You know, we need it. The smelling like the 70s. There's more mice living in that thing right now. That I have a trap line actually set up in there, and I put a big jar of peanut butter at the end of it. I say, if you guys can make it through that, Godspeed.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. John Nelson, the vice president of the USA High School Clay Target League, joining us in just a little bit. Right now, though, I want to talk with Joy Pullman from the Federalist. We were chatting with Joy last week about what's going on at Stanford with the vote to restore Western civilization. Joy, how you doing today?
Good afternoon. Doing well.
Good. I appreciate you coming on the program. So the vote last Thursday and Friday... It did not go well for the future of Western civilization, Joy.
No, it was an overwhelming decline. I think about 3-1 vote margins, Stanford students decided they don't want to all take a Western civilization course.
So at the risk of, I was going to say, how does that make you feel, Joy? Because it's all about feelings now.
I was just thinking that.
Right? But you know, what is your reaction to this? Obviously, you know, we talked about why we think Western civilization is an important subject to learn about.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is like college level civics courses. I mean, it really is. You know, when you're in middle school,
yeah.
When you're in high school, you're taking civics and government. Well, Western civilization is just the college level version of that.
Well, I'm going to be honest. So I try to write optimistically because I can't handle all of the depressing things in the news. But I was not expecting the vote to go, to go for Western Civ simply because that is not the atmosphere that we have in education right now. So it would have been really a wild outcome. So I guess I can say I am disappointed, but I'm not surprised. And so I think what, so I've been, you know, if I want to broaden the discussion a little bit, and when we're thinking about all the problems that our country faces, I think a lot of folks on the conservative side like me, you know, we want things to be able to be fixed in an election. We want it to be able to be fixed, you know, in these kind of one-shot sort of events. But, you know, the work of rebuilding a culture is going to take many generations, and it's not going to be, I think, you know, won by elections, even though we put a lot of our energy and efforts into it, and we think that, you know, this or that presidential candidate's going to be our savior. So I think things like this really ought to remind all of us that, you know, what you teach your own children around your own table, the fact whether you're having kids or not, those sorts of kind of really basic things are things that conservatives should start to be tending their own gardens, to be thinking about what I call the long game. You know, whether Western Civ is going to continue to be here in 50 years or not.
Absolutely. And, you know, to that end, I would say for a couple of years now that I think it's we need to start viewing conservatism almost as the countercultural movement as opposed to the dominant movement. And certainly on college campuses, you know, look, I think there is something to the idea that when you're young and you're growing up, you like to rebel a little bit. You like to push back against the status quo. You know, maybe honestly, Joy, maybe we need to start looking at Western civilization as you know, ideas that that people don't want you to learn about. You know, these are what dangerous ideas are to be found in Aristotle and St. Augustine and you know, the Western
really,
canon.
Yeah, it's absolutely clear right now that the man is the left.
Right.
You know, they own the commanding heights of culture, of industry. And we're going to be in the world. I mean, look, I don't like saying this, right? I want to think that I can just move to the Midwest, to a nice conservative state, and that my kids, you know, I can protect them. But you know what? I'm just being realistic, that's not true. You know, it's going to get darker before it ever hopes to get lighter. And so we have a lot of things to be doing. You know, so we have a lot of things to be doing. One of them would be, you know, don't send your kids to Stanford. You know, stop buying, you know, the idea that, well, the name brand, you know, is worth something. It's not worth something. And, you know, votes like this are really proving that.
I will put that. Listen, I'm already going to check that off my list right there. Don't send my kids to Stanford. Done. That's the easiest bit of activism I have ever performed, Joy. Holy cow.
Well, I mean, I'm using them as a stand-in.
No, I understand.
You know,
I'm not going to send them to Harvard or Yale either. I will make that
industrial complex.
Sure.
Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no, they're not going to any of those schools. Listen, I'm talking with my kids about trade school, honestly. I have a 15-year-old son.
Yeah, I am too. I'd be proud for my sons to do something beautiful with their hands, something that requires hard work and a long life of apprenticeship.
Absolutely. And this is, I think, again, you talk about, you know, rebuilding the culture or retaining the culture or restoring or whatever verb you want to use, you know, that's a big part of it, is that there is, I think, value found outside of the academy. And look, I'm not anti-education. I'm very pro-education.
Me too. Uh-huh.
I think that, you know, people should continue to learn even when they're not in school. But I also think that there's absolutely nothing wrong, as you say, with learning a trade, with being an honest laborer and living by the fruits of your labor. There's nothing wrong with that.
That's absolutely right. I mean, and if folks, I mean, want to send their kids to college, I have a list on the Federalist. You can probably search it up of some, I think it's 14 colleges that are, you know, upstanding, great places where your kids won't be indoctrinated, you know, and that have very good quality academics. Their graduates go on to do well. You know, so look, we need to increase, vote with our feet and not stop buying the party line about how, A, everyone needs to go to college, like you're saying, and B, you know, I need to go to name brand university and you basically supply my kids into the little liberal factory.
Yeah, and if you're there, be a rebel, right? You know, carry
yep.
carry around your little pocket constitution and your copy of the Federalist Papers and, you know.
Just like these kids did on Stanford. I'm so impressed with, if you read the things that they wrote that were was defending the Western Civ proposal, beautiful, beautiful. You know, the attacks against them were kind of, I mean, almost barbaric and laughable in comparison. You know, the response to them was, well, we need to get Wells Fargo banks off campus. You're thinking, that's not a response. That, you know, why don't you find something, you know, some injustice in the world that actually exists, like, you know, women sold into slavery, and maybe we'll deal with that.
Well, you know, and it's interesting that you bring that up, because at the Ohio State University, there was, and this didn't get a lot of attention because it ended fairly quickly, but there was a group of students who were occupying, I think it was the president's office in the administrative building. And they told the media, we're staying here until our demands are met. And about 8 hours in, the president said, it was getting towards midnight, and the president of the Ohio State University said, look, if you stay here, you're going to be arrested for trespassing. So you need to leave. And there was much whining and much complaining. And you know what, Joy? They all left. You know, not one of them are willing to spend a night in jail for the beliefs that they, you know, held so dearly. They figured out, you know what, there's probably another way that we can advance our cause. They were not willing to get arrested. They were not willing to go to jail. If you start standing up to the snowflakes, again, you don't have to be cruel to them. You just have to say, no, it's midnight. Everybody wants to go home, and that means you too. We expect you to be treated like adults, and we're going to treat you like adults, whether you like it or not. It's amazing what can happen.
Oh, it is. And it's actually, that's a really stark contrast to what most of the university presidents have been doing as these Black Lives Matter sorts of folks have been rampaging around campuses this school year. And you know, I just look at that and you think, doesn't anyone have any courage, right? How do you get to be a quote-unquote leader without having a basic quality of leadership, which is courage? Well, I mean, there's, you know, an obvious answer to that, which is that nowadays that's not considered a qualification for leadership, and that's one of the reasons we have many problems with our culture today.
Absolutely. Listen, Joy, I really do appreciate you coming on the program. It's always good talking with you, and hope we get a chance to do this again soon.
Same here. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Joy Pullman joins. You can read her at The Federalist. Again, a list of colleges that are not Stanford University. And that is, you know, it really is truly disappointing to see a vote like this. Because, like I said, Western civilization, in my mind, is sort of the college level version of civics and government. You know, you're learning about everything from Plato's Republic to St. Augustine to the Magna Carta. It's the basic story of how we got to where we are in the United States today. That's it. To say, I don't want to learn about this, seems to me to be bizarre. Now, look, if you wanted to, I'd even be willing to say, let's have equal time. You want to have a semester-long course on Western civilization? You want to have a semester-long course on Eastern civilization, non-Western civilization, whatever it is you want to call it? Fine. Again, learn more. You're at Stanford University. You should be learning more. That's why you're there. But the idea that we would not want to learn, I don't want to be taught about this stuff, that's what's kind of disturbing to me. Because if you don't know how we got here, then can you really appreciate what we have? You know, I saw yesterday, the day before, there was much discussion on Twitter about whether or not we should have, I say we, most of us were not involved in the process, but whether or not the United States should have dropped the atomic bomb on Japan, on Hiroshima and Nagasaki at the end of World War II. And it just struck me. My dad is going to be 90 this year, veteran of the U.S. Navy, 17 when he joined in World War II, and he was off the coast of Okinawa, he's off the coast of Japan, in the Pacific Theater when the bombs were dropped. A young guy at the time. I've talked to him about it a little bit. He's 90. He still has nightmares about what he saw just from his position on a destroyer off the coast of Okinawa. But what he saw happening there on that island. He's lived with these nightmares his entire life. There is no way on earth that we, who were not a part of that experience, who didn't live through World War II, who don't have any firsthand knowledge of that, there's no way that we can ever really know what it was like to live back then, what it was really like to have those experiences. We don't have a draft. We have a volunteer military. Most of us will never know what it's like to serve in uniform to defend this nation. But when we lose that perspective, when we fail to realize that, oh, yeah, you know what? We don't know what it was like. we can learn a little bit through history. But when instead we decide it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what it was like. It doesn't matter what they actually thought back then, because you know what? I'm superior now. Because we are the most moral, most intelligent, most everything generation, putting the greatest generation to shame. When we have that sort of arrogance based on ignorance, because we don't care what came before, because we've been told that everything that came before has been crap. Again, do you know what you actually have? And are you willing to hang on to it? Are you willing to build on it? If you think that everything that that came before was just garbage. And apparently the students there at Stanford, by a 6-1 margin, Joy got it wrong. It wasn't 3-1, it was 6-1 margin. Apparently they said, no, we're happy not knowing this stuff. All right, we're going to take a timeout. John Nelson, who is the vice president of the USA High School Clay Target League, will join us on the program after a quick timeout. Stick around. We'll be back with more NRA News Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, right after this.
I'm speaking with Kellyanne Pidgeon with Armed and Feminine. Kellyanne, welcome to NRA News. How are you?
Great. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. Tell folks, what is Armed and Feminine? What do you do and why?
Armed and Feminine is my business that I created to teach firearms training for women only. When I got into shooting several years ago, there was no one I could find that was female, and it was a little difficult because men are from Mars, women are from Venus.
No.
So I went to an NRA training through the Well-Armed Woman and became an instructor, and I came back and started this, and it took off like wildfire. People came from all over the tri-state area. I'm in Pennsylvania, and they loved the idea of women teaching women. You know, we have to know, how does this work? What is it called? What does it do? We have to feel things, touch things, and that's what the entire classes are based around, is women teaching women, because we're different. We have smaller hands. We're not as strong. We're curvier in different ways. Totally different on how you have to learn how to shoot.
Right, and especially with certain firearms, the fit, whether it's revolver, semi-automatic, if you're handgun, it's a different fit for a woman's hands versus a man's.
Absolutely, and that's actually one of the draws about my class, is that when someone comes, all they have to do is bring a lunch. I bring everything, eyes, ears, materials, and an array of firearms, and so do my other instructors. So they have an opportunity to pick and choose from all different firearms to see what fits for them. And everything is different, and it's funny, I have a video out that akins the firearm to buying your bra, if we can go there on this segment.
Of course, we always go there here.
And I say that nobody can buy your firearm but you. You know, when someone said, oh, my husband bought this for me, and I just want to roll my eyes and go, really?
Honey, I got you a 44 Magnum. It's called the Dirty Harry Special. Enjoy.
Exactly. And they're never going to want to shoot again. Like,
no.
Guys are like, honey, try this big firearm. So we start with 22s till we get all the fundamentals down pat, and then we move up to 380s and 9s until they figure out what it is that they like. But I tell them, you know, it's just like your bra. It's got to be comfortable. It's got to fit right. You got to be able to wear it every day, and it's got to be able to do its job. So only you can do that.
Perfect. Speaking with Kellyanne Pidgeon with Armed and Feminine. So, Kellyanne, you say you're from PA. What part of the state?
I live near Pittsburgh.
Okay, I'm a PA guy myself, and in Virginia now, but it's always good to have a fellow Pennsylvanian here.
I find them everywhere. Actually, I found a man right who lives not by me from.
That's
here.
Awesome. So, why was it important that you do? You talked about you didn't find it, but. You went way beyond. I can't find a woman to instruct me. You started this whole thing, and it takes a lot of work and a lot of drive.
It does.
What drove you to do this?
I know how much I enjoyed it and what learning this trade did for me in terms of confidence, et cetera. I'm all about mentoring women. I won the Athena Award locally for mentoring women and trying to help move them. And in the classes, I found women who were housekeepers, from housekeepers to attorneys and everybody in between. And what I saw is that women who may be fearful in one way or another, once you teach them how to safely handle a firearm, their confidence just goes through the roof. And if they're having a bad day or they feel like their back's up against the wall for something, they just have to remember, hey, I know how to shoot a gun, and I can do that pretty well. I can do anything. And so, you know, I just enjoy helping people. My real job is in human services, and folks look to me for leadership sort of all the time. And so it was just sort of another calling that I had, and I found it to be a passion. I thought, if I'd only started this 10 years earlier, this would have been awesome. So I enjoy it. I enjoy every minute of it.
How can folks get more information about Armed and Feminine?
Actually, they can visit my website. It's armedandfeminine.com, and all the tabs are there, from frequently asked questions, class descriptions. All my classes are pretty much sold out for the next season. It's crazy. My entire 2016 season sold out in 5 days. 5 days. I had to add more slots to that during the week to try to just meet the demand.
Okay. So before we run out of time here,
sure.
What's your message to women who are watching us going, should I try that? What do you tell them?
Don't be afraid. You can conquer your fears. It's worth it. And we need to move from being the protected to becoming the protector. And women will save the Second Amendment.
Wow. That's awesome.
Well, they will.
That's awesome.
Give me 30 more seconds. Because women who are the matriarchs of their family, whatever they like, believe in, and support, so will their children. And so women are on the move, and we're moving this, and we're going to be a big part of saving the Second Amendment.
Kellyanne, thank you so much. Keep doing what you're doing. Thanks for being on NRA News.
John, thank you. It was my pleasure.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. Coming up next hour, Mr. David Webb, Mr. Dave Workman. Right now, I want to welcome to the show the Vice President of the USA High School Clay Target League, John Nelson, is with us. John, how you doing, sir?
Hi, good afternoon, Cam. Thank you for having us on.
Absolutely. It is fantastic talking with you. And I got to tell you, I mean, I've really enjoyed reporting on this story over the last few springs. We've seen the headlines out of Minnesota and just the staggering growth in the number of students who are participating in the state's high school clay target program. I mean, you guys are over 10,000 students now, right?
Well, we're over 10,000 students, and we have, you know, over 300 high school approved teams participating in the league in Minnesota. And there's a program that in just 2008 had 30 students in it and only three teams. So obviously you've been seeing the growth of the league, and it continues to go.
That is amazing. 8 years ago, 30 students and three teams, and now you say you're up to over 300 high schools that are participating. So, John, how did you get from where you began to where you are now? What ingredients needed to be in place to see this sort of flowering that we've seen?
Well, we often say that it took us about 13 years to become an overnight success. And, you know, through those years and since the league has started, through the proof of performance that we've been able to provide in activity to high schools that is not costing them any money or facilities or maintenance or staff members, and it's providing a safe activity for their students, whether they're male or female, or if they're an adaptive student in a wheelchair, is we've provided a great alternative to sports and activities at the high school that everyone can enjoy. And so once schools started to embrace that, the word of mouth through aggressive marketing efforts to those schools and representation, we've been able to succeed just simply by having them contact us and getting involved.
Is this something that can be replicated in other states around the country, and are we actually seeing this now being replicated in other states?
We are. What we did in 2010, because of the success of the Minnesota program, we had some of our neighboring states, including Wisconsin and North Dakota, of teams that wanted to kind of jump the border and join the Minnesota League. And we thought, hey, why don't we just duplicate what we're doing in Minnesota and these other states to see what level of engagement we would have there. So our Wisconsin State High School Clay Target League program started with four teams and about 60 kids. And this year that's over 50 teams and over 1,000 kids. Our North Dakota program last year was four teams and about 70 kids. And this year it's over 500 kids and about 25 teams.
Wow.
So it's gained that momentum, not only in those that are joining the state, but we've also launched 9 additional states this season. So we've received inquiries literally from every state in the country. And so what we've been able to do is to open up some of our kind of low-hanging fruit of people who had a very high interest in getting the program going. That allows us to start up the league in these states. And what we see is we see some early engagement in getting some of these school-approved teams on board.
Mm-hmm.
And all of these states are at larger levels than what Minnesota was in its first year. So we expect substantial growth in those markets for many years to come.
That is absolutely fantastic to hear, John. And, you know, again, this is something that you talked about, the appeal for the students themselves as well as the parents. You know, when we lived in Northern Virginia, my kids would have gone to a high school with about 5,000 students. And unless you are a spectacular, stellar, standout athlete, you're not going to get a lot of playing time on the football team or the baseball team or the basketball team, right? I mean, you're just not. You are competing for that time. This is something that it seems like all students can participate in, and all students really have a chance. Depending on, you know, their level of ability, they have a chance to be a champion.
Absolutely. And if you're the 10th best player in a baseball team, that's not a lot of fun to be sitting on the bench all season.
Mm-hmm.
And so as it comes to the sport, you don't have to be the tallest or the fastest or the strongest or even the right gender to participate in what we're providing for the trap shooting league. And so that's what's made it terrific for these families. And so what's happening within these teams are not only are they starting out with large numbers, but soon these teams are becoming the largest participating teams in their school. It's because everyone on the team, when they show up, they get to play. They get to shoot.
Talking again with John Nelson, the vice president of the USA High School Clay Target League. John, if people are listening here and they're like, "Wow, I want to do this where I am," I mean, how do you get started with something like this? What would your advice be?
Yeah, well, currently we're running marketing efforts in 17 different states, and if somebody goes to usaclaytarget.com, they'll see the participating states that are currently in our program. If that state is there, you can simply go in and select the start a team to get more information about how to start a team at your local school. For those that don't have the program in the state, we are currently working on offering additional states for the 2017 spring season, and that program will come out early this summer.
All right. Yeah, I just was there. Right now, Virginia, not one of those states, so let me know what I can do to help, John.
Thanks, Cam. Absolutely. We'll do our best to get it in your own backyard.
Ah, that would be fantastic. Listen, I really appreciate you coming on the program. I think this is such an amazing a thing that y'all are doing, and I'm so glad to see again that the enthusiasm and the success of the program has been so great.
Thank you very much, Cam. Appreciate your support.
Absolutely. Look forward to talking again soon, John. John Nelson joining us, vice president with the USA High School Clay Target League. Again, in Minnesota, the fastest growing activity in the Minnesota schools. 8 years ago, 30 students, 3 teams. And now over 300 high schools participating, over 10,000 students competing. This is fantastic. And again, where are these headlines? Have you seen any news about this anywhere? I mean, I will say this. In Minnesota, the press is covering the story. And not in a sensational way. They're simply reporting on what's taking place. They're actually reporting from the state high school trap shooting championship. But again, considering the phenomenal growth that you've seen around the country, you really haven't seen a lot of coverage. What you've seen, I guess, this is what passes for the coverage. You've seen the stories of gun manufacturers are trying to hook kids on guns, right? Like that's how this would be covered. Not that this is a fast-growing sport. You're all dupes. That's the tone of the game. If you're letting your kid participate in something like this, oh, my gosh, you're just a pawn of the gun lobby. Or maybe there's something wrong with you. Meanwhile, you actually talk to the parents and you talk to the students, and they love it. The family travel costs are minimal, the league says, because practice and competition are conducted at a shooting range near the school's location. Safest sport in high school there in Minnesota. No reported injuries since the inception of the league in 2001. And again, your child can actually compete. Now, this isn't like getting a participation trophy. You know, you shoot what you shoot. Your score is what it is. But you can compete. You don't have to have started out your career path towards high school football in the, you know, what, first grade in order to guarantee a starting position. You don't even have to have, you know, started shooting at the age of 8. You can start as a freshman, never having picked up a gun before. And again, you can end up being a champion. There, even at the high school level, there aren't a lot of sports like that out there. I have nephews down in Texas who play baseball. Baseball is a big deal in Texas. This isn't Little League. You've got traveling teams, I think at like age 9 or 10. And if you're not on the traveling team, if you're not on those squads, and then when you move up into middle school and in high school, if you're not playing in the summer, if you're not doing all of those extra things, if it is not a year-round activity for you, you're not playing varsity baseball. Same goes for football. Same goes for basketball. This is something that people can actually participate in, which, again, I think is why you're seeing such a tremendous turnout and why I hope that we do see this replicated around the country. The states, by the way, where they are shooting the clay target leagues, Arizona, Illinois, Kansas, Kentucky, Michigan, Nevada, New Mexico, New York, Ohio, Oregon, Pennsylvania, South Dakota, Texas, of course, and Utah. And as John said, there will be more of these leagues coming. So next hour, the Hour of Dave's with Dave Workman talking about the gun tax in Seattle. We also are seeing more reaction to the $1,000 excise tax that the Northern Mariana Islands has put in place for people who want to be a gun owner. And there are some other restrictions, by the way, that the Northern Mariana Islands have put in place. It's not just the excise tax. There are a lot of other laws that they've approved that I can't see how they stand. There is the provision that you have to have that firearm locked up at all times. The D.C. versus Heller decision struck down the district's provisions requiring firearms to be locked up with ammunition stored separately because of the inability to use that firearm in self-defense. But the powers that be there in the Northern Mariana Islands apparently willing to take their chances. What's fascinating is that, you know, again, we've seen this script before, both in Washington, D.C., and in Chicago, after the Heller and McDonald decisions. And you saw, after those decisions, the local lawmakers, they didn't say, man, we feel horrible. All this time, we've been actually blocking people's fundamental constitutional right to keep their arms. That's awful. We better make sure that we respect that right. No, it was the opposite. It was, well, we don't think they have a right still. How do we make it as hard as possible? Given that we can't ban handguns, how do we actually make it as hard as possible for people to practically exercise that right? And that's what we're seeing here in the Northern Mariana Islands. So Governor Ralph Torres has signed the $1,000 excise tax. He said, this is something that none of us wanted to have, meaning the right to own a gun. He said, I don't think anyone here in this office wants to see handguns on the street. Unfortunately, however, the only option we have is to make regulations as strict as possible. That's one of the other provisions, by the way. No carrying of a firearm outside of your home. The right to keep and bear arms is not the right to keep and bear arms. The Attorney General there in the Northern Mariana Islands, Edward Menabusan, said, quote, in the first place, we don't want it. This is not something that we want in the Commonwealth, the proliferation of handguns. Or one could say ownership of handguns. Because, again, if they've been banned, then one handgun being bought is proliferation, I suppose. Nonetheless, he says, we worked hard with the governor and members of the legislature to ensure that we have legislation in place, and that's why we are here today. This bill, he says, provides strong language to ensure the safety of gun owners and that of citizens from the people who own guns legally. Yes, we're protecting the citizens from those who own guns legally by making sure that those who own guns legally can afford to pay the extra $1,000 for the purchase of that firearm. Well, we have already seen, again, one court decision come out against the Northern Mariana Islands. I am guessing, although this is certainly not a lock of a judicial decision, but I am guessing that we are likely to see another decision telling the Mariana Islands to go back and revisit their gun laws at least one more time. Stick around. Hour two of NRA News Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, is coming up. We'll be back right after this quick timeout.
I'm here with Ashley Levinsky. She is the curator of the Cody Firearms Museum. Ashley, good to see you again, and thanks for being back on NRA News.
Thank you for having me.
Now, last time when we talked to you, our good friend Phil Schreier was here. He's not here this time, so I have you all to myself.
Oh, yeah, we don't have any guns today.
That's okay. We're going to talk all about the museum. It's such a cool place, and you're such a great representative of the Cody Firearms Museum. So tell folks, what is the Cody Firearms Museum?
Oh, man. The Cody Firearms Museum is actually, it's one of five major museums at the Buffalo Bill Center of the West, and we also have a huge research library, and there are guns in every single museum. But the Cody Firearms Museum has 7,000 firearms, and they start all the way back to 1425, and they go up through modern day. And so there's literally something for every interest. We've got, obviously, the American West guns being in Cody, Wyoming. But then we've also got an extensive military history collection, embellished arms collection, Hollywood guns, you name it, it's there.
And I love, Ashley, how there's such an integral part of American history, how you can tell the history of the country through its firearms, starting all the way from
1425.
Yeah, all the way up. It's so great.
Well, you know, it's so interesting to me because when we got our start, you know, we were the Winchester Arms Museum, and that came from the Winchester Collection, which was loaned and then donated to us. But it was always, you know, so much more than just, you know, the American West. I mean, the American Western story just was international to the Winchester Company. And so they collected international firearms. They collected historic firearms that predated Winchester, obviously, with 1425. And so, you know, they recognized how important this firearm story was all over the world and how it impacted the American West. And so it's amazing that you could literally take one firearm and just tell so many different stories.
And you guys are going to talk, like my good friend Phil Schreier, we always say, if that firearm could only talk.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
And what would it say? So when you guys get together with Phil and your other curators, you know, we've got 7,000 firearms. Well, I got 10,000. You guys ever get into any contest or anything?
Yeah, it's usually more like, oh, you got that gun? You want to loan it over here? Loan that one?
It's like a poker game.
It really is. But, you know, what's so great is that I love that the museums really complement each other. I mean, they've got some... I actually had to laugh. I went down to the NRA Museum's booth, you know.
Right.
And they had... Right now, they're displaying one of Eisenhower guns and one of JFK's guns. Well, so are we. We did not plan that at all.
I love it. That's so great. Well, you know, so tell folks some of the most compelling stories and stories about some of the firearms you have. So stuff that's really piqued your interest.
You know, I'll talk about the first gun that I worked on back 5 years ago when I first came to the Cody Firearms Museum. And it was a Colt 1861 Navy, and it was serial number one.
Of course. That always helps.
Yeah, original leather holster. And, you know, first off, I mean, you know the 61's great, and and it's got this great history, but, you know, it was one of 100 made with a fluted cylinder, so it had that kind of rarity to it. And then it also, we knew who it belonged to. And not only did we know who it belonged to, it wasn't given to, like, a general or something. It was a private who happened to buy it. It was made on April 9th. They actually wrote the date underneath the strap. And so it was April 9th, 1861, and his name was Caleb Slate. And Caleb Slate enlisted in the American Civil War in, I think, May 20th or 21st of that year. And so he just happened across number one.
Wow.
And the fact that we can then trace that gun through the American Civil War, and then the history kind of gets fuzzy until it ended up at an auction. Someone bought it and then put it on loan to us. And to me, to see one, a significant model, you know, with its own technological history, but then you have the military side of it, and then to find an actual soldier and a personal connection to it, just doesn't get much better.
Awesome. How can you get more information about the museum?
All right. Well, you can go to thecenterofthewest.org. You can actually read about all five of our museums, and we're at Cody Firearms on Twitter.
Ashley, thank you so much for being on NRA News.
Thank you for having me.
Welcome back. Hour two of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, starts right now. On the program this hour, David Webb, host of The David Webb Show on SiriusXM and Patriot 125 and the growing scandals of Bill de Blasio. I promise we didn't show a picture of the snake just because I was talking about Bill de Blasio. That was just total random. Dave Workman, the Seattle Gun Rights Examiner, join us a little bit later on in the hour as well. We've got the Hero of the Day, sponsored by AdCorp Defense, at the top of Hour 3. Deal of the Day, Good Guy of the Day, Tim Lee with the Center for Individual Freedom, Stephen Cruiser with PJ Media, joining us on the program as well. And I mentioned at the start of the program, we were going to share a clip from Howard Stern during this segment. I saw people talking about this morning online. No, liberal Howard Stern with a surprising support for the Second Amendment. Now, again, if you are a regular listener to Howard Stern, this isn't a surprise to you. Howard Stern has been a concealed carry holder in New York City for quite some time. He has been a vocal supporter when it's come up, I think, of the Second Amendment for quite some time, but it recently did come up on his program. And I thought what he had to say was actually really interesting. So take a listen to Howard Stern talking about the right to keep and bear arms.
Joel, go ahead. You're on the air. In Wyoming?
Yeah, Howard.
I believe
how's
Wyoming.
Going?
Yeah, you're going well. Thank you, Joel.
Hey, I was just kind of curious. You say you support Hillary Clinton, and you know, she came out and she said that the Supreme Court got it wrong about the, you know, a person's right to own a gun for self-defense.
That's the one issue I really am nervous about voting for her. I believe the Second Amendment issue is one of the most important, and I got to tell you, I think about it more and more. I really do. I think every citizen needs the right to be armed, especially, you know what, I call it an equalizer. You know, you think about it. If Robin was walking alone in a parking lot, and two men were going to approach her with the idea of robbing and raping her.
What's my only
option? What is her only option? In other words, let's say we took away all the guns on the planet. Now there's no more guns. I think people would be less safe. Now, this is just my way of thinking about it. The men who could, you know, fight with swords and with knives and with baseball bats and bare fists, they'd have no power. They'd have every opportunity to overpower a young woman walking alone, an older gentleman who no longer can fight, a 30-year-old just out of prison who's been working out like a monster and weighs 250 pounds of pure muscle. I believe the world would be so out of control. Now, the great equalizer is the pistol, semi-automatic weapon, or revolver.
Louis C.K. just made the point. He goes up against women who are going to become professional boxers, and he says it hurts less.
Yeah, well, look, the bottom line is, how would these people defend their home, their property? You'd say, well, they'll call the police. The police can't be everywhere, and you can't call police when the shit's going down. It goes down in seconds.
You can hardly pull out a gun. You can't call the police.
Exactly. You know, and I'm not even saying that, listen, I know gun violence is horrible, but and guns get into the wrong hands. I'm all for a national registration and things like that. But at the same point, I don't know how else, if all the guns were gone, how else would you defend yourself against a thug with a baseball bat with a chain around it? How how the hell would you could protect your family, your wife, your children? Or how would a woman protect her property and her life and her, you know, preventing being raped without a handgun? It's the only thing that equalizes.
That's right. You know, like in Wyoming, I live in a pretty remote area.
Yeah, you don't have a cop living next door to you, and you're not a wealthy man.
No.
And a lot of people who are for this irrational gun control laws have private security forces, a lot of politicians.
Right.
They don't understand the real world.
Well, I don't think that everybody needs to be walking around with a gun in their pocket, but you have a right to own a gun.
Well, if the gun's locked up in the house, what are you going to do? I mean, if you're in a parking lot, I believe Robin Quivers has the right to
Robin
walk around.
Robin Quivers runs.
Well, you can run sometimes, and sometimes you can't.
I don't go into places like that.
Well, and by the way, you try to be street smart is what you're saying, of course. But not everyone is. Sometimes you're being street smart, goes down.
Yeah.
Do I have that right, Joel?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I'm 15, 20 minutes from the closest sheriff ever getting to my house. Or if they ever took the right of way to defend yourself, what am I supposed to do?
Joel's right, especially in
rural areas.
Remote areas.
Yeah.
There's a lot of crime, a lot of meth heads all hopped up, and they want to get in your house. And God knows what they're going to do to you. And you know me, I'm pro-police. And I've talked to many cops about this, and most of them agree with me.
All right, thanks, Joel.
Thank
you.
So, yeah, that is a dilemma for me.
So there you go, courtesy of Howard 100, the liberal Howard Stern, saying, you know, the one thing that has me queasy about voting for Hillary is my Second Amendment rights, because I think that we need our right to keep and bear arms. And Howard worried that Hillary might take that away. Well, now, why would he think a thing like that? Crazy talk, isn't it? Oh, no, I'm sorry. Probably because she's, again, trying to run as the most anti-gun candidate in U.S. history. Yeah. Bernie Sanders, by the way, is fighting back a little bit anyway. He put out a release talking about Clinton's credibility gap. It reads, quote, Clinton's credibility was questioned after she blamed Vermont for gun violence in New York. The charge backfired when the Washington Post called her assertion significantly misleading. Even Vermont Governor Peter Shumlin, a Clinton backer, said she was wrong. Quote, it is campaign season, therefore things are sometimes said by all the candidates that sometimes aren't entirely accurate. That's what the Vermont governor and Clinton superdelegate Peter Shumlin told Vermont reporters. So, Bernie Sanders puts out this statement on his campaign website, Clinton's credibility gap. Again, she had talked about Vermont crime guns flooding the state of New York. In 2014, the ATF reported that there were 55 firearms that were recovered in New York State and traced back to an original retail sale in Vermont. 55. There were nearly 1,400 firearms recovered in New York State, traced back to an original sale in New York State. But none of that matters because Hillary Clinton is trying to bash Bernie Sanders on the gun issue. Because, again, this is, she thinks, one area in which she can stand out as long as she doesn't have to talk about 2008 and trying to run to the right of Barack Obama on the gun issue and bashing Barack Obama for wanting more of those icky gun laws when people in Montana, you know, they shouldn't have to have the same kind of laws that people in Manhattan have. Yeah, that was Hillary Clinton 8 years ago. It ain't Hillary Clinton today. So Bernie Sanders points this out. And the Hillary camp's response is beautifully Clintonian. Nick Merrill, who is a campaign spokesperson for Hillary Clinton, put out a tweet, Bernie Sanders' campaign has completely lost its compass, it would seem, because they put out the release called Clinton's Credibility Gap. Let's be very clear, Nick Merrill says. This is a character attack. This, he says, is exactly what Bernie Sanders pledged to supporters he wouldn't do. This is a character attack on Hillary Clinton. she got it wrong. She's got it really wrong. I mean, look, there are plenty of character attacks that could be made against Hillary Clinton. I don't particularly see this as a character attack. Unless you want to talk about the character of someone who would, again, lie about the problem of gun violence and its solutions in order to try to win votes. I mean, you want to talk about, like, you know, how character matters there. I'm going to have that argument. But, I hate being in the weird position of defending Bernie Sanders' statements. But I just don't really see how this is attacking the character as much as it is attacking the actual substance of what she said. But this is where we are now over on the Democratic side. And it looks like we will see more of this through the New York election and beyond, as a matter of fact. Newsbusters pointed out that Clinton's surrogate, Howard Dean, was on MSNBC. You know, he's the former governor of Vermont. Peter Shumlin, a Clinton superdelegate, stood up for his state, said, "Now, this is ridiculous." Stood up for the facts, too. Howard Dean, not so much, as it turns out. Chris Matthews, legs a-tingling, asked Howard Dean about, he said, quote, "Did you feel you were the arsenal of criminology or crime in New York City? Did you feel that your state was feeding guns down across the northern border?" Howard Dean, who was governor from 1991 to 2003, said, quote, "Well, they do, actually. We do. We do. We do feed guns down across the border. We are responsible for the crime in New York." He said, except that it's misleading in the sense that while we are the highest per capita exporter of guns, that's because Vermont is so small. But Bernie's real problem is his vote against the loss, against the ability to sue gun companies. He says it's not the largest exporter of guns, but there are a significant amount of guns bought in New York. I don't think this is an article about semantics. This is a problem because Hillary is to the left of Bernie on this particular issue. Uh-huh. So, yes, we are to blame, but the bigger problem is Bernie Sanders' support of the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act. And, it's really not about semantics. It's because this is just because Hillary's to the left of Bernie on this issue. And rawr! I don't know if he actually stopped with the scream, but that's what I would have done just to try to distract people from my awful answer. As Newsbusters reported, Matthews was left speechless and turned to MSNBC national correspondent Joy Reid to joke about whether or not Clinton was trying to instill Vermont guilt on the Green Mountain State. Joy Reid saying that's got to be a hashtag, somebody's hashtagging Vermont guilt right this instant. And then she said, "I think what you see here is an example of the dangers of talking around an attack, right?" Matthew said, "Vermont is now like Mexico for drugs. It's the home base of all bad guns. Has Hillary overstepped here? Your objective, yes or no?" Joy Reid says, "Yes. Yes, Hillary's overreached here." Chris Matthews says, "Can you help me out here? Particularly, is Hillary overstating the charge? Is she overcharging Vermont as the source of the gun battles, the crimes down in New York? Everybody knows that." And Joy Reid said, "Yeah, absolutely." You know, again, it's not a character attack when it's just a lame attack. And again, if Hillary Clinton wants to convince people that she's going to reduce violent crime, blaming Vermont seems to be a really poor way to go about it, doesn't it? You know, meanwhile, 538, Nate Silver's blog with the New York Times, or no longer with the New York Times, I'm sorry, it's been its own site for a while. Rob Arthur, Jeff Asher with a story, "Gun violence spiked and arrests declined in Chicago right after the Laquan McDonald video release." Now, we've seen other stories indicating this. We've actually seen the numbers for a couple of months now. But the release of the Laquan McDonald video came right about the same time as well that the city of Chicago settled a lawsuit with the ACLU. ACLU said that Chicago police were making investigatory stops more often than they should have been, more often than they need to be. They're just harassing people. So the paperwork required for officers every time they do an investigative stop doubled. The form they had to fill out to talk about why they stopped that individual has doubled. So there are a couple of theories about why we are seeing a pretty dramatic number of drop in the number of arrests in Chicago. At the same time, we are seeing a pretty dramatic spike in the number of violent crimes. 538 says, after some cities saw a rise in crime last year, police chiefs and even the head of the FBI suggested that the United States was experiencing a Ferguson effect. Police officers sensitive to public scrutiny in the wake of protests over the 2014 killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, were pulling back on police work, the theory went, and emboldened criminals were seizing their chance. They report the evidence for any such effect nationally was mixed. One of the other writers at 538 analyzed crime data from 60 major cities in September and found an increase in homicides in some places, but a decrease in others. Chicago had seen a 20% increase in homicides from the year before, but crime statistics are volatile. They say the crime spike in Chicago since the end of November, though, is too sharp to be explained by seasonal fluctuations or chance. There have been 175 homicides, approximately 675 non-fatal shootings in Chicago from December 1st through March 31st. And they say the 69% drop in the non-fatal shooting arrest rate and the 48% drop in the homicide arrest rate since the video's release also cannot be explained by temperature or bad luck. They say news coverage of the recent spike in violence so far has focused on the murder count since the beginning of the year. But they say using Chicago's open data portal, they were able to pinpoint the start of the increase in gun violence in the going along policy of the policing slump to the wake of the release of the video showing McDonald slain. Since then, though, it's interesting. There has been a spike, then there has been a drop almost down to pre-video release levels, and then there's been another spike. It's not that if the thesis is that, well, it was only the release of this video that caused the spike in violence. It's not that we've seen, you know, crime going down and then the video gets released and all of a sudden crime starts going up again. Nope, crime is going down, the video gets released, crime goes up, then crime goes back down again, and then crime starts spiking back up. 538 doesn't really explain why we might have seen two separate spikes in violent crime, particularly when it comes to the non-fatal shooting incidents. But they do tend to believe that there is something to the idea that there is less policing intentionally taking place. They quote a department spokesman who said that several measures of policing had risen in March, noted that the pace of the homicide increase had slowed. Said clearances are something that we certainly acknowledge are a problem. He placed some of the blame for the decline in arrests on people involved in shooting incidents, quote, not cooperating. 538 says, in Chicago, there's little concrete evidence of an organized police slowdown, but in both public statements and private conversations, former and current Chicago police officers, crime analysts, and journalists have described a climate of low morale and hesitation among officers that has led to fewer arrests. President of the police union told NPR last month that, quote, no one wants to be on that next video. Jamie Calvin is a journalist who has covered the McDonald case, who knows several Chicago police officers, says that he is skeptical that there is any sort of mass protest among police, that this is some sort of organized effort to, hey, you know what, slow it down, everybody. And then we'll show them. He says he thinks Chicago police are bewildered by a more hostile public, pointing to a slogan that has become increasingly popular among police, shared on police blogs, and even sold on T-shirts, stay fetal. stay fetal. What does that mean? Well, apparently it comes from a comment by Mayor Rahm Emanuel, who said in one of his few public appearances recently that officers had, quote, gone fetal in order to avoid trouble. Jamie Calvin says there is a genuine lack of clarity about the job description, the parameters of the job, and who will have their back in ambiguous situations. Now, again, this is a real issue. And this is an issue that is likely to get worse in Chicago, in part because of a lack of leadership. Hillary Clinton doesn't want to talk about what's going on in Chicago. She certainly didn't talk about Rahm Emanuel when the Illinois primary was going on. Hillary Clinton is using the gun control issue pretty shamelessly as a political issue, and pretty shamelessly as purely a campaign issue. The attacks on gun owners, on the gun lobby, on the NRA, on gun manufacturers, on political opponents, that's where her anger is really focused. It's not focused on the criminals who are committing these violent crimes. In fact, she can't acknowledge the criminals who are committing these violent crimes. In one of her attacks on Bernie Sanders, on the Vermont guns flooding New York State, she talked about guns from Vermont coming and committing crimes in New York. Guns committing crimes in New York. Because she cannot talk about the individual violent criminals. Because it's about gun control. It's not about safer streets. It's about gun control. It's not about public safety. It's about gun control. It's not about fixing these broken communities. It's about gun control. Because she's told that this is a year that gun control is a winning campaign issue. All right, we're going to take a quick time out. When we return to the program, David Webb joins us, host of the David Webb Show on Sirius XM Patriot 125, talking about the mayor of New York, Bill de Blasio, and his growing scandals. He found out what it felt like to slide under Hillary's campaign bus after she said, hey, you know, this skit that's getting a lot of grief here, I had nothing to do with it. It was all Bill de Blasio's idea. And this is the minor problem for Bill de Blasio right now. There are much more serious concerns for the New York City mayor. We'll talk about it more with David Webb right after this quick timeout here on NRA News, Cam and Company.
Speaking with Dennis Willing with the NRA Competitive Shooting Division. Dennis, welcome back to NRA News, and we are talking Bianchi Cup. It's that time of year again. What is the NRA Bianchi Cup?
Bianchi Cup is NRA action shooting. It is not a run-and-gun type sport like you see in some places, perhaps like three-gun, but it is a stationary sport where you compete against the clock. It's a combination of speed and accuracy, not of one's agility.
All right, and it's out in Columbia, Missouri, and it's in May 24th to 28th, correct?
Correct.
All right. And Dennis, we see some of the best shooters from around the country and quite frankly from around the world come out to Bianchi. Why is that?
It is just a very exciting sport that people enjoy very much because of it combines the speed and accuracy elements. We have a tremendous number of international shooters come over from Australia, New Zealand, and Germany, and who knows where, Canada. And we have recently generated interest, believe it or not, down in Chile. They're now running Bianchi Cup matches in Chile.
It's amazing to see this all coalesce at a shooting club in Columbia, Missouri every year. It's an amazing thing to see. And this year, brand new, a feature, a new championship round presented by Colt. That sounds like fun.
It is. It's going to make for an exciting finish. We're going to take the top divisions and divide them out and put them on the line. They're going to shoot head-to-head. They're going to shoot their first round, and then they're going to shoot a second round for the top competitors, and they're going to shoot for the cups, the women's cup, the men's cup, the production. It's going to be an exciting finish.
All right, Dennis Willing, thanks for what you do at NRA, and thanks for being on NRA News.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
I want a woman president, but I want an honest president more. I want someone who can place their hand on a Bible and swear to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution without telling a lie. someone who believes in the integrity of that office, a president whose actions reinforce the moral lessons I teach my children. There are many powerful, accomplished women in both parties who meet and exceed that standard. But you, Mrs. Clinton, are not one of them. Your past is littered with shameful, dishonest behavior, decades of decisions that point toward your own power and fortune, not the best interest of women, the country, or the truth. There is no greater threat to my freedom than another dishonest president. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
I'm a mom, a business owner, and a patriot, but I am not a politician. A few years ago, I founded a nonprofit to defend voters' rights and stop election fraud. We exposed corruption, so the corruptors wanted me silenced. The IRS, FBI, ATF, OSHA, and a U.S. congressman turned my life upside down. Their investigations were invasive, abusive, relentless, and political. They demanded every social media message I'd ever posted, the name of every group I'd ever spoken to, and every word I spoke. I was supposed to give up, but I am not a victim. I'm an American, and I will not stand by and watch while our freedoms are picked off. An attack on one right is an attack on every right. So, I fight. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company. Dave Workman, the Seattle Gun Rights Examiner, still to come on the program this hour. Kicking off our Hour of Dave's, David Webb, host of the David Webb Show, right here on SiriusXM Patriot 125. How you doing, my friend?
Doing all right, Cam. How's it going?
You know, it's springtime in Virginia. Things are going pretty well. A lot better for me than it is for Bill de Blasio these days, but... That's not saying
I'm sorry, much. I just couldn't help but laugh.
Yeah, so let's get started with the lighthearted scandal, the non-scandal, David, because, you know, Bill de Blasio, Hillary Clinton, they're Democrats, and they're good progressives, so they cannot go astray. They absolutely cannot go astray. So when they're on stage and they make a joke about CP time, frankly, by the way, as I said, I wasn't joking. I really thought there was a reference to Communist Party time, but apparently not. This is they're getting some light pushback on this skit. And Hillary Clinton basically threw de Blasio under the bus, said, listen, I didn't know anything about it. It was all Bill's skit. You'll have to ask him. I defer to him. Hillary Clinton deferring to a man, David, deferring to the mayor of New York on this issue.
Yeah, and a big supporter of hers. So let's look at this for what it is. First of all, had Bill de Blasio had the balls to say colored people time and deliver it with good timing, it would have been a funny joke. I'm a First Amendment guy. And by the way, this is an insider's club. It's kind of like one of the dinners I go to. I go to a few a year. Some are in a comedy club, some in an event hall. You make fun of each other. This happens, and political correctness is off the table. So the hypocrisy here is, if a Republican had said it, would have been immediately called a racist, would have been shouted down, the media would have gone apoplectic, there would have been wall-to-wall coverage. They say it, and it's not. But I don't care about that. It was not a funny joke. I think the joke's on the American people that I like yours better. Frankly, Communist Party time is more accurate when dealing with Bill, with Bolshevik Bill, or the opportunist Hillary Clinton, who will sell anybody out to be an oligarch.
Yeah. Well, as I said, though, this is sort of the minor problem for Bill de Blasio right now. It is the one getting more headlines, but there are more serious issues, from what I understand, David. The U.S. attorney for New York, who's been leading a big corruption probe, as I understand it, he's starting to look at some de Blasio donors there in New York City.
Really? I'm shocked. You mean that anyone that supports a far-left progressive could possibly have issues with corruption? That never happens in politics. Look, here's where Bill de Blasio comes from. He comes from the worst of the worst. Let's not kid ourselves. This is a guy that is supported by the likes of the Working Families Party, the Communist Party, the far-left agenda groups like Christine Quinn and her bunch when she was in the council and then out of it. And they are willing to do anything and use any method necessary to advance their agenda. That, by its nature, is the very beginning of looking into potential corruption. When they talk about the relationship between de Blasio and a slew of officers through the ranks and the businessmen, you begin to see a deeper potential for problem here, because you're talking about a collusion between a mayoral agency and, frankly, a slur to the NYPD, or not a good thing, because it's not the members of the NYPD or the leadership even, but people within the ranks who may well be implicated in this, including changing numbers, including fixing reports, not reporting correctly what's going on in the precincts. So there's so much more here possible that could, you know, be really dangerous for the citizens of New York.
Absolutely. And a lot of the reporting, David, is focused on this de Blasio nonprofit called One New York, right? Which I didn't realize this, but Newsday reported that this basically de Blasio folded up the group last month, quote, after it was bashed by watchdog groups as a shadow government of lobbyists at City Hall. So this sounds like this is a fairly complicated story as well here.
Yeah, there is a lot, and that's the influence peddling part of it. And come on, this is a guy, let's go back to Hillary Clinton for a moment, who supports Hillary Clinton, who are running the Clinton Foundation is essentially a global criminal enterprise. Why not have in the largest city in America a shadow group that can influence your policies that you want to address and leave on the table, especially when de Blasio is concerned about being a one-term mayor?
So it was the One New York nonprofit. Was that sort of his Clinton Foundation?
Yeah, essentially that's how you set it up. The model exists. This is how Soros operates in the various groups he supports. This is how the Clinton Foundation operates. Look at their control over USAID. Look at the way they structured it. It's all about creating a secondary level, kind of a Chinese wall of influence where you can take in enough, and if there's a legal issue, you can push it off on the foundation. And that's what people don't talk about enough. If there comes a problem, the Clintons can say, well, you know, the foundation's so big we couldn't watch everything. De Blasio can say, well, that's a One New York function. We're going to clean that up, but we're okay at City Hall.
And I mean, how is this weighing on de Blasio's popularity there in New York City, David? I mean, for a while, I think you had to say that de Blasio had a honeymoon period. There were a lot of folks who were really excited about the progressive turn that the Big Apple was going to be taking. How do New Yorkers feel now?
You know, the New Yorkers, and I separate the progressive bunch, which is a very small group of, 23% that voted for de Blasio out of a city of 8 million, they don't care. The rest of the people have already seen the dangers of a de Blasio administration. They're living their reality with the crime that's growing, the lack of proper policing, B&Es going up, assaults, sexual assaults in some precincts, changing of CompStat reports at the precinct level, police officers hanging on to their scratch pads in case they run into an issue later because they work their cases through the day or their arrests or their incidents, and by the time it gets in and it gets out the door at the end of the day, it's been changed from, you know, assault with a weapon to maybe assault one, whatever they've been, you know, they've reclassified them, which is a big problem. That doesn't mean that the people don't see the results of this in Brooklyn or in the Bronx because of the problems in the Bronx, including an overloaded prosecutor's office. 60%. Roughly 60% of criminals that are arrested and go into the system go back out on the street.
Wow. That is, you know, look, and here's the thing. I think maybe nationwide that is not you'll probably find those numbers elsewhere, David, but that doesn't mean that it's not a problem. It doesn't mean that it's not an issue. And if you're living in one of these struggling communities, one of these neighborhoods that you know, politician after politician after politician has told you, hey, listen, I'm going to devote time and energy and resources. We're going to make your life better. And nothing ever really changes. In fact, if anything, the neighborhoods get worse. You know, how do you respond to that in what is many times seen as sort of a one-party town in New York?
Yeah, and it will remain a one-party town for quite some time. Democrats outnumber Republicans in registration literally 10 to 1. So the Republicans have failed on their end to begin a, you know, precinct by precinct level or council seat by seat going after districts to start to change it. You have a small group of voters driving this progressive agenda and a Mayor Bill de Blasio. And then on top of that, you've got the Upper East Side, Upper West Side, Tudor City crowd, which is the, you know, the more wealthy areas. And you won't hear anything from them till suddenly crime, you know, migrates into their areas, and suddenly they can't walk up and down the street with their progressive morality and not run into whether it be homeless, crime, or something else that they don't like in their neighborhoods.
Talking again with David Webb, host of the David Webb Show. David, listen, I appreciate you coming on the program, sir. What are you going to be talking about on the program this week?
Well, it's a busy week. You got the New York State GOP dinner. That's tomorrow night in here in New York City with all three presidential candidates. You got what I'm calling the second battle for Brooklyn for you Revolutionary War fans or those students of history. Battle of Brooklyn originally in 1776 in August of that year. The second battle for Brooklyn is Thursday night between Bernie and Hillary, and that's the opportunist against the socialist. And both of them, if either one of them became president, could reverse what we started to do in the original battle of Brooklyn. Covering that, covering the dinner, covering the candidates. Tonight I'm going, actually right after this, Cam, I'm headed out to the Bernie Sanders rally. And I am going to go there and ask them how they live and cover and believe and support their socialism, among many other things. So, you know, I give them all a chance to give me answers. Let's see what they do.
All right, David. Listen, I appreciate you spending some time with us, sir. It's good to catch up with you. Hope we can do this again very soon.
Anytime, my friend, anytime.
All right, we'll talk again soon. David Webb, you can catch him, of course, weeknights, 9 to midnight on SiriusXM Patriot 125. And then, of course, we join David right after that at midnight Eastern, 9 Pacific. All right, we're going to take a time out here on NRA News Cam and Company. Dave Workman, the Seattle Gun Rights Examiner, join us to talk about Seattle's tax on firearms and ammunition. How is this actually working for the city of Seattle now that it's been implemented? We know it's not working well for the retailers there, but how's it working out for the city? We'll talk about it with Dave Workman coming up right after this.
Speaking with Mark Holyoke with the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation. Sir, welcome to NRA News. How are you?
Great.
Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, great organization. Love the work you guys are doing and have done. We've got new things to talk about. First, Mark, tell folks who don't know, what is the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation all about? What do you guys do?
Well, the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, we're a wildlife and land conservation group, for lack of a better term. You know, you have Ducks Unlimited for ducks. We are that for elk. Basically, we look out for wild elk and for the wild places where they live. We conserve land, we protect land, and we look to improve habitat all across elk country.
What are you doing? Anything new?
We've got some new things going in the fire. We just launched a campaign, a social media campaign, a digital campaign, if you will. Hunting is conservation. And people hear that and they're like, hunting is conservation. What does that mean exactly?
How is that possible, Mark?
Tell us. How is that possible? Well, basically, and a lot of hunters don't even know this or quite understand it, but hunters put so many dollars on the ground and already have such a care for the environment and animals as it is. But when you look at the licenses they pay, the fees they pay, the donations that they make to conservation groups like ours, and then when you look back in time and you look at the whole Pittman-Robertson Act, which, if you're not familiar with that, back in the early 1900s, a lot of wildlife was going away for different reasons. It was being hunted on the market, so to speak. And hunters stepped up at that time and said, hey, we have a problem here. A lot of our species are going away. And so they self-imposed a tax on themselves, on their guns, on their ammunition, on their bows and their arrows. And the fishery folks later did this later with fishing equipment as well. So since that time, we've generated more than $8 billion that's gone toward conservation efforts. And so hunters are the backbone of conservation efforts since then and today.
I'll tell you what, Mark, you couldn't have explained that more eloquently. I talk about that all the time. why hunters are the number one conservationists, and that is the best. I'm going to clip that and send it around to my friends. No, it was awesome because that is so important to people, especially those, you said, within the hunting community, but people who aren't hunters understand, say, oh, hunters are out there trying to kill all the wildlife and destroy the underground, and it's not true.
Yeah, it's not true, and it is. It's the bottom line. Like I said, not just the caring and the connections that are made between so many of us who live in cities nowadays, but it's the actual funding of paying for and providing funding for state wildlife agencies. They're the ones, the fish and game agencies, right. They're the ones who take care of wildlife management. They're
huge.
The ones who look at conservation efforts. And so our funding as a hunting community takes care of that and provides what's needed to make that happen.
Yeah, and you know, once again, people who don't understand that, if all the hunters, Mark, were to go out there and kill all the wildlife and destroy all the forest, then what would they do to continue to hunt? So it behooves
right.
them, besides
right.
their fees they pay, it behooves them to take care of the populations, to control them, help cull them when necessary, grow them when necessary, and also take care of the habitat as well. So, okay, how did Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation get started?
Well, it began back in 1984. There were four just good old boy hunters in northwestern Montana, and they cared for the elk, and they cared for the surroundings around them, and they thought, well, you know, who's looking after this particular animal? I mean, if you hunt, if it's turkeys, if it's deer, if it's ducks, whatever, you know, we know what that's like to be a hunter. But to hunt elk, I mean, they live in certain places and certain landscapes that are incredible. And at that time, there was no particular organization looking out just for elk. And so they decided, and they pooled their efforts, and one of them almost caused a divorce because he took college funding for his kids out of the bank and applied it to this organization, and it hung on by a thread. And then today the ball's rolled forward, and as of right now we have more than 220,000 members and more than 11,000 volunteers, and they're just doing great work for us.
That's a guy who's dedicated. Foolish, crazy, but dedicated. Yeah. So who's the typical member of the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation?
A typical member is just someone who cares to make just a little bit of a difference, to not just be so solar focused on crosshairs on a game, but to understand what that really means. And so, I mean, we have people who are life members. We have people who donate decent sums of money. The bulk of our membership is just probably year-to-year members.
Mark Holyoke with the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation. About 20 seconds left. How can people get more information?
Just go to rmef.org. Also, follow our social media campaign right now that hunting is conservation, and we just appreciate the support.
rmef.org.
O-R-G.
Mark Holyoke, Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation. Thanks for what you do, and thanks for being on NRA News.
Hey, thank you.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company. Tim Lee with the Center for Individual Freedom with a rare midweek Liberty update. Join us next hour. Stephen Kruger with PJ Media Plus, Hero of the Day, sponsored by AdCorp Defense, top of the hour, deal of the day, good guy of the day. And right now, the Seattle Gun Rights Examiner, Mr. Dave Workman, joins us on the program. How you doing, Dave?
I'm fine, Cam. How you been?
I have been good. I'm looking forward to the NRA annual meeting coming up here in a little more than a month in Louisville, Kentucky. Hopefully, you're going to be able to get out of Seattle and head down there for that.
Yeah, you betcha. I'll see you there.
Excellent. And in the meantime, let's talk about what's going on in Seattle. You know, the city council has gone a little tax happy there, Dave, passing this $25 per gun tax. 5 cents for a round of ammunition, with the exception of 22 long rifle. Then it's only a bargain tax of 2 cents per round of ammunition. The law was signed, and now it's actually gone into effect, right? So retailers,
yeah.
Gun owners, they're having to live with this in Seattle. What's happening there now?
Well, an appeal has been filed. As you probably know, NRA, along with the National Shooting Sports Foundation, Second Amendment Foundation, a couple of the gun stores, and two private citizens have actually sued the city in state court for violating the state preemption law, which was passed back in 1983. Yesterday, I filed what we call a Public Records Act request. It's like a FOIA request with the city. I waited until a few days after the end of the first quarter to file that request. I want to find out how much, if anything, the city has actually collected in taxes on the sale of firearms. They've run one of the gun shops out of the city already. He's gone elsewhere, and the other one is hanging on as a plaintiff in the case. And you know, we're just going to see how this shakes out.
You know, it seems to me, Dave, that there's already, you know, look, you just have to look at the law of supply and demand. If people can get their firearms or ammunition cheaper, they're willing to drive a little bit farther. They may not even have to drive as far, depending on where in Seattle they live. They're you know, without even getting the politics involved, they're likely to go elsewhere.
But then
when you add in the politics, look, there are a lot of gun owners. I won't say every one of them, but there are a lot of gun owners who will intentionally drive out of their way to avoid paying this tax because they feel like they are being treated as the cause of violent crime in Seattle rather than the violent criminals themselves.
Yeah, this is typical of a far left. I mean, so far left, you're out in the Twilight Zone liberal approach to crime. And as I've said many times, I think even on this program a few times, Seattle is only about 20 minutes in any direction from the United States. So people are going elsewhere to buy their firearms. And we'll see when I get a report back from the city how much, if anything, that they've actually collected in gun tax. You know, they passed this thing with claims that they were going to collect anywhere from $300,000 to $500,000 a year in taxes. And, of course, what they want to do with this is spend it on gun control programs.
Mm-hmm.
They're forcing the law-abiding citizens who own firearms in the city of Seattle to pay for really ratcheting down on criminals. And, you know, it doesn't really make a lot of sense, but when have they ever made sense? So.
Well,
here we are.
Yeah, unfortunately, you're right. And you know, look, we've seen in Seattle, we saw the high-profile shooting gain national headlines in the homeless encampment. What was it called?
Right.
The Jungle, right?
Yeah.
Now Seattle's making headlines for another brutal murder, a mom whose remains were discovered in a recycling bin, a guy with a criminal history held in her death. You know, if you're not willing to deal with the actual criminals, Dave, and instead, as you know, we saw Hillary Clinton talk about this. She talked about guns coming to New York and committing crimes from Vermont because she can't talk about the individuals who are committing the violent crimes. If you're unwilling or unable to diagnose the problem, how can you offer any real solutions?
Well, yeah, and my take on that is that Hillary has been looking to demonize guns simply to shore up her voter base and get them to the polls. Bernie Sanders, he gets a low grade from everybody in the gun rights community, and yet he's being pilloried by Hillary for voting with some good sense over the years on such crazy things as the crime bill and the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Firearms Act. But then yesterday, maybe you saw this too, the Washington Post fact checker really took Hillary apart over that claim about the crime guns coming from Vermont. She was really disingenuous about that, and I wrote a column about it today on Examiner. And I know there were a couple of stories yesterday about it. I wrote something for the Conservative Firing Line. And this is just another indication that they're trying to get elected. Hillary is trying to get elected, I should say, on the backs of gun owners by blaming us for all the problems in the world. You know, Cam, I think you and I should confess right now, we sank the Lusitania.
Well,
let's get that out of the way.
Right. You know, what's interesting is, look, you're absolutely right about that. She is trying to win the nomination on the backs of gun owners. But something that the media hasn't really reported on, Dave, is that Hillary Clinton, look, I think she will win New York, but she's lost eight straight before this. And, you know, she lost Wisconsin. She lost Wyoming. The more she hits Bernie Sanders for the, you know, slight differential that they have on the gun issue, it really doesn't seem to matter, even to the Democratic primary voters.
Yeah, Rasmussen was out today with an interesting poll that they took, I think, on the 11th and 12th. And it revealed, once again, as you and I both know, that a majority of the Democrats, in this case 64% of the people who identified as Democrats for this poll, still think that it's too easy to purchase a firearm in this country. And that suggests to me that those people have never tried to buy a firearm in this country. It's just mind-boggling.
Well, they just they don't have to, Dave. They just watch Samantha Bee. Or, right? And they don't have to actually have any firsthand experience about this.
That's true.
But, you know, and that's true, but that also leaves a third of Democratic voters who say, nah, not really interested. And that doesn't, you know, that doesn't even gauge the intensity of support for additional gun control laws. I think overall, Rasmussen found, what was it, 44% of Americans said they thought that we should, you know, tighten up the gun laws, make more restrictive gun laws on the books. That's not 50%, Dave.
Oh, yeah. I think the pendulum started swinging back right after San Bernardino and maybe even after Paris. I talked to gun shops a lot, and I'd correspond with them. I talked to people in the business. That was a game changer when those two terror attacks took place in, of course, gun-free zones. And California has been trying to make itself a gun-free zone. But I think people looked at that, and it suddenly occurred to them that, hey, we're really not as safe as the administration has been saying we are, and we're not as safe as the gun control people say we would be without firearms. And a lot of people lined up at gun shops for the first time in their lives to buy a firearm. That was a big wake-up call.
Look what happened in San Bernardino itself. There, last report, this is about a month ago, there's an 18-month waiting period to meet with the sheriff for your concealed carry license because the demand is so high. I have yet to see the story in San Bernardino, Dave, of gun owners going and dropping off their firearms to be destroyed because, you know, they just don't want to have them anymore.
Yeah, I don't think you're going to see that story either. This has been a phenomenon that, you know, unfortunately, several people had to die to make this happen. And I think the blood is really on the hands of the gun control people here. The honest citizen, the average Joe Blow, Larry Lunchbucket citizen, has come to the realization that, gee whiz, all of this rhetoric that we've been spoon-fed for the last couple of decades is hogwash. And now it's time to take responsibility for my safety and the safety of my family. I'm going to take that step and do it. You know, that's the downside of the upside.
Well, you know, listen, I think ultimately the people responsible for the violence in San Bernardino were those who perpetrated the violence. But we have seen this very heavy-handed cultural push right now, Dave, towards trying to tell people, including single women, don't own a gun, right? Certainly don't date a gun owner, but don't even own a gun. If you own a firearm, you're putting yourself at risk. And, you know, so you've got gunsplainers like me that they want to highlight. They don't want women to hear from people like Kimberly Corbin. They don't want women to hear the story of Amanda Collins. They don't want people to have an actual educated an informed conversation or debate on this subject. They want to tell people what to think, what to say, and what to do.
Yeah, and fortunately for guys like you and me, they can't really tell people not to listen to us. And when people listen, they learn something. They get a different perspective. Women, according to my understanding from the National Shooting Sports Foundation, it's the fastest growing segment of the shooting population. More women are buying guns. And, you know, they do it for a variety of reasons, mainly self-protection, but certainly because they like the sport, the camaraderie, and they discover a whole new way to reach out and make new friends. But I think the pendulum, as I say, has started swinging back pretty good in favor of the firearms owners and the Second Amendment.
I think that you're right. Let's hope that this pendulum swing continues. Dave, unfortunately, we're almost out of time here, but I appreciate you coming on the program, sir. And if we don't talk before then, we'll see you in Louisville.
Always a pleasure, Cam. And remind them they can read my stuff at SeattleGunRightsExaminer.com.
Absolutely. Dave, thank you, sir. We'll talk again soon.
You bet.
And we've got Dave's latest column up on our Twitter feed, at Cam and Company on Twitter. In Nevada, the Bloomberg-backed background check referendum is going to be on the ballot in November. It's going to be question one. Nevada Secretary of State Barbara Sigafsky announcing on Monday that this is going to be on the general election ballot, along with the initiative to regulate and tax marijuana, which will be listed as question two. Uh-huh. So, it's an eight-page initiative, just common-sense gun safety reform measures that take eight pages to discuss. A short version would require private sellers of firearms and those who want to make a private transfer of a firearm to go through a federal firearms licensee. Violations will be counted as a gross misdemeanor, which in Nevada carries a penalty of up to 1 year imprisonment or a fine of up to $2,000 or both following a jury trial. So, again, this is going to be on the ballot in November, very similar to the ballot question in Washington State a couple of years ago, very similar to the legislation that was passed in Oregon last year. And you talk to not the lawmakers, mind you, but you talk to the law enforcement officers in Washington State and in Oregon, and you ask them, has this helped you? They'll tell you no. Has this been easy to implement? A lot of them will say it's been impossible to implement. Is this grandstanding as opposed to a real solution? Oh, yeah. You'll hear a lot of that. Stick around. Hour three of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, is coming up right after this quick time out. Right now, I want to welcome to the program Jason Redman. From Combat Wounded Coalition, and, you know, obviously we've had Jason on the program as well talking about his book. Jason, how are you, sir?
I am awesome. I mean, obviously I'm out here at SHOT Show. You're in Vegas. You're with just amazing patriots who love this country, the Second Amendment. They love freedom. And you know me, that's all the things that I stand for.
Absolutely. And so you are out there. You're not just seeing the sights. I mean, you've got a product that you are showing off at SHOT Show this year, right?
That's right. We are pretty excited. So I have partnered with Miltac Knife and Tool Company. They are a great company based out of Texas. And they've been a huge supporter of Wounded Warriors, Special Operations Wounded Warrior, and they support us, Combat Wounded Coalition and Wounded Wear. And, you know, we just started talking, and I have always been a huge fan of edged weapons, of knives. And Craig Sword, the head of Miltac, said, hey, Jay, what do you think about making a knife for yourself, the Jason Redman Overcome Knife? And that was probably about 6 months ago, and it led to this amazing product right here, which this is the first prototype. This is the unveiling today. But this knife captures my life, and it was based off the idea. You've got the Tanto blade, which carries us back to the original samurai, you know, that warrior spirit. This knife is also similar, many aspects of it, to what I carried when I was wounded. It is designed for, you can use it with fighting, you know, the fighting pommel, single tang, single piece of metal, so great strength, great versatility. It can be a good fighting knife. It can be a good field knife. And the red and black actually represents the aspects of my life. Those who have read my book, The Forging and Reforging, know that the forging part was when I was a young, new leader, made some mistakes, almost ended my career, and had to dig myself out of that hole. So the black paracord represents that that period, the original forging. Of course, the red represents the blood I shed on the battlefield and the blood that so many other warriors have shed. And so that is the forging and reforging. Of course, having the JR Overcome logo on it. So this knife is for anybody that has that mindset that I can overcome adversity. I tell you, working with Miltac a couple of years ago, I did a hog hunt. I used one of their knives, very similar to this, and I took down I got a boar. Anybody that's never done that before, hunting wild boar with dogs and knives, it was amazing. But their knife, it did the trick. It was fast. It was efficient. And that boar was down quickly.
That is awesome. Our friend Ron Bellin invited me, actually, to go on a hog hunt that way. And, unfortunately, I had to pass up the opportunity, but I hope to go at some point because it sounded like no hunt that I've ever heard of before, Jason. I mean, it sounded like you are really getting back to, I mean, you're getting awfully primal when you're hunting hogs with knives and dogs.
You are, and you just get caught up in the energy. I'll be honest, it's one of the few things, maybe next to skydiving, that brings back that adrenaline rush that you would get when you were in combat before you would go into a building or before you were taking something down. I mean, the dogs start, you know, they catch scent of that boar, they go after it, and you're just running through the woods trying to go after these boars. The dogs try and pin it, and you go in with the knife. So all of this coming back together with the idea of creating that overcome knife, you know, for a guy like me who got severely wounded, got put back together. You know, all of you know my motto, my mantra is overcome. It is what that's what I talk about. So pretty neat to work with Miltac and come full circle and now have this knife.
Welcome back. Hour 3 of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, starts right now. Tim Lee with the Center for Individual Freedom later in the hour. Stephen Cruiser of PJ Media joining us on the program as well. We have the Hero of the Day, sponsored by Adcor Defense. Looking forward to seeing the Adcor guys out at the annual meeting in Louisville here, along with the folks from Nosler, in a little bit more than a month now, May 19th through the 22nd, Louisville, Kentucky, the NRA annual meeting. I hope to see you there as well. I'm going to be issuing some regular reminders over the next couple of weeks here that if you're planning on attending the annual meeting in Louisville, and you have not yet booked your travel, including your hotel stay, do it now or do it soon, because there are going to be tens of thousands of NRA members there in Louisville. This is going to be such an amazing time. We are going to just be throughout the city. If you've been to an NRA annual meeting before, you know how big these events are. And Louisville is going to be no exception. So make sure, I would say, you know, book early. We're kind of past the book early stage. So book soon, or you may be sleeping in your car or crashing on somebody's couch or something like that. But NRAAM.org, that's the website. And you can find out more travel information right there at NRAAM.org. All right, let's get to our Hero of the Day, sponsored by Adcor Defense. It comes from the Palm Beach Post down in Florida. The story of a homeowner defending herself against, well, actually the homeowner's son defending mom against the intruder. Happened, this is again from the Palm Beach Post, but it happened out of Bessemer, Alabama. A man who broke into a stranger's home in Bessemer, Alabama, got a surprise Sunday afternoon when the homeowner's son confronted him at gunpoint. Deputies responded to a reported burglary in progress at a home just after 3:30 Sunday afternoon. Found a man identified as Nicholas Lee Harrison lying on the ground as another man held him at gunpoint, according to authorities. The armed man, who was not identified, told deputies that he was at his home next door. He saw Harrison pull into his mom's driveway. He didn't recognize the car, didn't recognize the driver, and he knew that his mom wasn't at home. He went outside to investigate and saw Harrison kick the front door to his mom's home wide open, and that is when the son went back to his place, grabbed his handgun. He said he found Harrison walking down a hallway inside his mother's home. Jefferson County Sheriff's Office said he ordered the offender out of the residence and told him to lie on the ground, and that's where deputies found him when they arrived. Now, the suspect in this case, Mr. Harrison, says, I was just knocking on the door for directions, and the door opened. I just didn't. I just wandered inside. Wasn't trying to do anything. Investigators said that they found needles and syringes used for heroin on Harrison. Authorities booked him into the Jefferson County Jail Sunday afternoon on charges of burglary, attempted burglary, possession of drug paraphernalia, theft, and criminal mischief. And meanwhile, the son and his mom and her possessions, they're all safe and sound. Our deal of the day today from New York City, the website DNA Info, in the Williamsburg neighborhood of Brooklyn. Police say a man was shot while trying to stop a car thief. Shot in the leg by that thief as he tried to stop the individual from breaking into an SUV on South 2nd Street. The victim spotted 44-year-old Hector Bello. DNA Info says Mr. Bello has twice been arrested for murder in the past. Man spotted Bello carrying tools in his hands trying to break into a Jeep Wrangler just before 4 p.m. Tuesday afternoon. The 28-year-old and two other men raced out of a nearby building, confronted Bello as he was smashing his way into the car. A teenage witness said he broke the driver's side window. Three guys came down and they started beating him up. The man tried to stop Bello and hold him until police arrived, but Bello pulled out a gun, shot him in the right leg. 32-year-old Juan Perez, who lives on the block, said three guys were holding him down. Then he took out the gun. He was so strong, he shook him off. I heard three shots. Bam, bam, bam. I ran inside the building, Perez said. And police arrived in time to arrest Bello before he could escape. Victim taken to Bellevue Hospital, listed as stable. No other reported injuries. Bello, who lives in Bushwick, arrested on charges of assault and criminal possession of a weapon. He has a long, by the way, criminal possession, not illegal, not a felon in possession? Okay. Bello, DNA Info says, has a long criminal history dating back to 1990 when he was arrested for assault and DUI. He was arrested for murder in August of 1991, robbery in February of 1993, burglary in December of 1994, murder again in July of 1997, possession of a forged instrument in December of 2014. No word from DNA Info as to the outcome of those cases. But again, two prior murder arrests for Mr. Bello, who right now, again, arrested on charges of assault and criminal possession of a firearm. This, by the way, this is one of those cases. This is not on the front page of the New York Times. This is not leading the nightly news in New York City. This is one of those cases that, despite Mr. Bello's extensive previous criminal history, chances are good that the gun charge will be dropped, that the assault charge might be dropped, that the 3.5 years behind bars that Mr. Bello will be eligible for at the state level, or again, the 10 years that Mr. Bello would be eligible at the federal level, if in fact he's a convicted felon on any of those previous charges, that none of that will apply. And that what we will see is a standard plea bargain, and this guy with a lengthy rap sheet, two murder arrests to his name, will be back out on the streets in a very short amount of time. All right. On that cheery note, let's talk about our good guy of the day. From Albuquerque, New Mexico, KRQE. This is one of those stories that has gone viral, a picture worth a thousand words. It's a picture of an Albuquerque police officer walking down the shoulder of a road, pushing a cart full of belongings. There is a woman walking quite a ways behind the officer, carrying more things as well. The officer is Andrew Cook, and it was this weekend when Officer Cook saw a homeless woman on the I-25 frontage road. And it was dangerous for her to be there, so he needed her to not be there, but he didn't just say, hey, you need to move along there. He pulled over and he got out and he helped her move her things. Again, not a big thing, right? But it was a big thing for the woman in question. And apparently it was a big thing to a lot of people who drove by and saw this. Video went up over the weekend by the Albuquerque Police Department. As of Monday morning, more than 12,000 folks had seen it. Hundreds had shared it. And, you know, again, a minor moment is at least recognized. And hopefully, again, the folks who watch that have a better appreciation and understanding of the many, many good guys out there, including Officer Andrew Cook there in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Our good guy of the day. So we're going to talk with Tim Lee and Stephen Cruiser this hour. One of the things that we'll be discussing is what's going on in Chicago. The city council has gone along with Mayor Rahm Emanuel's recommendation. Eddie Johnson, I mean, he bypassed all of the recommendations by the review board, which is supposed to, you know, give the nominations to the mayor, and then the mayor can accept that nomination rejected. He rejected all that. And he named his interim superintendent a couple of weeks ago, Eddie Johnson. Now the city council has removed that interim title. Eddie Johnson is the new superintendent of police in Chicago. Same day that, by the way, welcome to the job, Commissioner Johnson. Because the same day that Eddie Johnson has taken over, a task force assigned by Mayor Rahm Emanuel has released a report that says racism has contributed to a, quote, long systemic pattern of institutional failures within the Chicago Police Department, in which police officers have mistreated people, operated without sufficient oversight, and has lost the trust of residents. The task force said, in part, quote, the community's lack of trust in the Chicago Police Department is justified. There is substantial evidence that people of color, particularly African Americans, have had disproportionately negative experiences with the police over an extended period of time. The report offers more than 100 recommendations for changes. And again, we've already discussed, in fact, earlier in the show, we were discussing the piece at 538 talking about the rise in violent crime at the same time that the number of arrests have dropped in Chicago. And there was a quote by a journalist who has been covering the police force who says, you know, I think the real problem here is the officers, again, are kind of bewildered at the community that doesn't. On the one hand, you've got people saying, we want more policing. Where are the cops? We live in bad neighborhoods, and we don't see the type of policing that we want to see. Then on the other hand, you've got members, neighbors, maybe even of the person who says, we need more police. Their neighbor might say, actually, no, I don't want to see more police. I don't want to see the cops around here at all. Because every time the cops come around here, it seems like innocent people are getting, you know, frisked, thrown up against the wall, getting arrested for nothing whatsoever. And by the way, we still live in a very violent neighborhood. You have two completely contrasting points of view on how the police need to be operating in these communities. Again, this is one of the problems here. Because there is no united front right now against the gangs who are driving the violence in Chicago. Not only is there not a united front between the city, rank and file law enforcement, and the community, you don't even have that unity within the community as to what the law enforcement response should be. The New York Times said that, quote, Mr. Emanuel said he was not surprised by the suggestion of racism and that he wanted to work through those issues. He says, quote, I don't really think you need to have a task force to know that we have racism in America. We have racism in Illinois, or that there's racism that exists in the city of Chicago and obviously could be in our department. The question is, what are we going to do to confront it and make the changes in not only personnel, but in policies to reflect, I think, the values that make up the diversity of our city? Again, while Chicago is dealing with a spike in violent crime, Rahm Emanuel is trying to reinvent the police department. He would say, again, to try to restore the faith of the community. But I wonder what the reaction of these officers, again, the journalist who has been covering the police department and many of the officers there said that, you know, a lot of these officers have that stay fetal mentality right now because they don't feel like the city has their back. And this is that fine line that Rahm Emanuel may be attempting to walk, but it looks like we'll see more from the mayor's office talking about the need to change the police department. Then we will, from the mayor, talking about the need for the community to work with the police department based on this report. I'm looking forward to actually having a chance to take a look at the report itself. Again, 100 recommendations, a lot of information contained within the report. I've not had a chance to look at it myself, just looking at the New York Times summary of it. But don't look for any sort of stability in Chicago over the next couple of months. Within the city, within the police department, I'll be honest with you, it looks like the chaos is going to continue there behind the scenes. All right, we're going to step away for just a moment or two. When we return here on NRA News Cam and Company, our friend Tim Lee with the Center for Individual Freedom joins us. You can find them online at cfif.org. Stick around. We'll be right back with more NRA News Cam and Company coming up right after this.
I'm speaking with Jim Sapieha, director of the NRA Museums. Jim, there's three museums. Let's talk about that third museum you guys have way out west.
That third museum is kind of a little hidden jewel box. It doesn't get the press that the other two bigger museums get, but it's a spectacular little display case. It's the Frank Brownell Museum of the Southwest, and it's at the NRA Whittington Center in Raton, New Mexico. Now, folks who are really shooters will know what the Whittington Center is, but those who may not be that active, it's a spectacular range and hunting complex that is owned and operated by the NRA. There are tens of thousands of acres out there with spectacular ranges where a lot of different championship matches are shot in addition to general recreational and sporting shooting. But they also have the Brownell Museum of the Southwest, and they have some great guns there. Of course, that history of that area is just spectacular, going back to the conquistadors. And they follow the evolution of firearms in that area throughout that multiple century span. They also have firearms that are used in the types of competitions that take place at the Whittington Center. And they recently got a spectacular group of modern engraved firearms. There are masterworks there that I have never seen the likes of before. So if you're in that area, it's a great area for vacationing. There's a lot of attractions in that area. Be sure you don't miss this little jewel box of a museum there.
And how do you get to see all the museums online?
Well, you can. We have several social media platforms. We've got, of course, the website, nramuseums.com. And, of course, we have our Facebook page. You can friend us there and get our Gun of the Day posts. So you can visit us on the Internet, Facebook, get the books. And for sure, come by and see the three museums. They're all open every day of the week, and admission is always free.
What is your barbecue of choice in Austin?
It is Terry Black's Barbecue in Austin. Nice. Love that place.
under siege by local authorities because apparently the smell of barbecue smoke is offensive in Austin, Texas. So, yes, go check it out.
It just irritates hipsters. That doesn't matter.
No, that's just it. It shouldn't irritate hipsters. I mean, that's the whole essence of being in Austin, Texas. But I was just giving Cam tips on good rib barbecue.
Mustard. Put the mustard. I've got a microphone. Yeah, thank you.
It puts the mustard on the barbecue or else it gets the hose.
Or else it gets the rub again, I believe is right.
All right, so I'm going to go back to my special across the street, across the lot.
Why are you leaving? Did we run you off there? All right,
no. I guess we have limited microphones and you know, something.
I'm really glad I got invited. It's great.
Why are you still here?
That's really good. That's fantastic.
Tony's used to a little more one-on-one time, a little special time here.
No, what we need is more Andrew Langer. That's the said no one ever, including his wife.
Dear God, it gets worse.
Lord. Wow. This is happening.
Oh, there you go.
I heard there was a party over here, and I wanted to just see what was happening. I'm trying to tape a special across the hall here, and it's getting very noisy, and I wish you would all. And who's the one with the British accent that keeps interrupting everybody?
Tony.
Oh, yeah.
That's right. It's Tony Katz.
I've lost complete and all control.
You've had about 3 minutes to think of a question, and you still haven't managed it.
Here's the thing. Who's the question to right now at this point?
Ask all of us. We'll all answer.
Okay.
What's the question?
Ask the question.
Ask the question.
What is the question?
There's a ratio, people. A ratio.
Here's my question for you. Obviously, you haven't had anything like this chaos on the show, on your show.
On my show?
Yeah, over the last couple of years.
It feels good, Larry O'Connor, like it did in the old days. This is how Larry worked his way through everything.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by our friends at Nosler, Stephen Kruger of PJ Media, join us on the program in just a little bit. Tim Lee with the Center for Individual Freedom, join us on the show right this very second. How are you doing today, Mr. Lee?
Doing well. How's everybody out there?
You know, we're good. I'm a little discombobulated, though, because it's not Monday and we're talking to you. So it's this special midweek hump day edition of the Liberty Update, and it's got me a little confused.
As John Lennon said to Mick Jagger in the Rolling Stones Rock and Roll Circus, not my fault, man.
Well, listen, I do appreciate you coming on the program. And I'm going to talk to you about this. I don't even know if you've seen this story or not, but I saw this yesterday, and it's driving me crazy. Up in New York State, Setauket, New York, there's a farm, Benner's Farm. And the Benner family's owned this farm since the late 1970s. They bought a cow about a year ago, Tim, and they bought a cow to raise it up to eat. And now they've raised it. Now it's time to eat the cow. And their neighbors are actually protesting because they say, we've come to appreciate the cow. We view the cow as a pet. We have to save this cow. People are protesting what their neighbors are eating for dinner, Tim Lee.
you set me up for this one, didn't you, knowing that my sort of closet animal rights sympathies, and I'm thinking Darren Lasort said, you know, let's stick it to Tim this week. Give it to him. You know, it. Kidding aside, and I'm one of those guys who looks forward to the day. It's not going to occur in our lifetimes, but where we are so advanced as a society that we can produce synthetic meat, and none of these poor cows have to be eaten, and I don't have to go to your Facebook page and see these little piglets and chicks that I know that are soon going to be on somebody's dinner plate. But it reminds me of that story. Maybe it was back in the 90s even. It's been a long time. And I think it sort of gained currency with Rush Limbaugh when he was sort of in his heyday before, cable news and whatnot, when he was one of the few voices out there for conservative thought in mass media. But you remember that oversized or record-setting lobster that got caught a few years ago? Maybe it's, like I said, been 2 decades now, but there was a giant lobster that was caught.
Yeah, I do remember this, yeah.
Yeah, it was maybe caught up near Boston, and just this enormous lobster. And I guess the restaurant that owned it, or perhaps the fisherman that grabbed it, I think was waiting for the highest bidder, maybe the restaurant was saying, look, you know, whoever bids the highest price on this will get to eat it. And the animal rights activists really threw a fit. And it's similar to the story that you just told in the sense that, look, out there, regardless of what you think about eating meat or vegetarianism, there are a lot of animals being, let's just say, sent to heaven so that they can be consumed by humans. In any hour out there, there are a lot of lobsters in seafood aquariums, and they're swimming around, and you go to the store and you can see them, and they're still alive. But this one, because it was the largest, somehow attracted the sympathies of the animal rights movement, and they protested this restaurant and really threw fits about it. And so it's similar to this cow. You know, there are a lot of cows out there, but this family somehow feels that it has standing to sue or at least protest because they happen to get to know it. And that's the state of our society right now. You know, we're not battling aliens or invading armies or, you know, the Black Plague. So I guess we have enough time on our hands now to protest other people's farm animals being slaughtered.
Right.
So it's a sign of our wealth and privilege and easy lives that we live in this country anymore.
You know, that's actually, you're right. It really is. And, you know, we've been talking about some of the campus protests. And I don't know if you saw what happened at the Ohio State University, Tim, but I thought it was interesting. It was, you know, started out as a sort of standard protest. Students come in, they occupy the administration building, they issue their list of demands. We're not leaving until our demands are met. And ordinarily, you know, we've seen a lot of instances where the university presidents, they wring their hands and they issue a statement of support and they say, we're going to work with these students to make our campus a better, more inclusive place. At the Ohio State University, the university president said, we're kicking you out, and if you don't go, you're going to be arrested for trespassing. And they all left, Tim. They all left. Not one of them got arrested. They all decided they had better things to do, which...
Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt you there. My recollection, it was that the president was even better in the sense that not only did he or she, I think it was a he, say that, you know, you'll be removed and arrested. My recollection, at least the story that I read, said that, and you will all be kicked out of school.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the way to handle this sort of thing. You know, you probably know this saying better than I do, not that you've ever served in the Soviet or Russian army, but I think it's a Russian saying that says something to the effect of, you know, you can push the bayonet until you hit something hard. And I think we often hear it referred to when they're talking about Nikita Khrushchev and the way he sort of tested John F. Kennedy after, you know, Eisenhower was out, and Eisenhower being obviously the man who freed Western Europe, or at least provided the leadership for it. And, you know, so Khrushchev was going to test Kennedy, and whom he saw as sort of this young, impressionable, naive pushover. And that's what obviously led to the Cuban Missile Crisis. But, you know, with the Berlin Wall and some of the other things, it was an old Russian saying that you keep pushing that bayonet through the soft tissue until you hit something hard. And this kind of illustrates that. And I think a lot of other issues in our society where people are too quick to sort of back down anymore. A lot of these protesters and all of these grievance groups, you know, across the nation, whether it's sort of the anti-police protests or anything else that's said shutting down campuses or protesting conservative speakers, they'll keep doing this until somebody either fights back or ignores them. The problem is we do give them too much attention, and we do sort of just cave into their demands and shrug our shoulders and say, well, you know, kids will be kids, and let's let them occupy the place. When people start facing consequences for it, that's when these sorts of things stop. And the same is true, and I don't mean to take this into an entirely new area, but Charles Murray, noted psychologist, I believe, psychiatrist, famous author of The Bell Curve, he came out with a book about a year ago now that I think it was entitled Of the People. And he talks about how civil disobedience is needed in America again. And, you know, when you and I talk on this show a lot about just the unending number of regulations that come out of the federal government and even state and local governments that shut people down and make our lives extremely difficult, there's going to come a point where people just say enough. And they either start ignoring it you know, dodging their taxes, going to the black market, paying employees under the table so they don't have to deal with Obamacare mandates or EEOC claims or Department of Labor rules, things of that sort. You're already starting to see it in this campaign. You know, when people talk about a lot of the anger out there, frankly, I don't agree with a lot of the voters, and I don't think it's any secret that I'm not going to endorse candidates here or oppose them, but I'm not as much one of those people that thinks the establishment is this horrible thing. I think people like Paul Ryan and people like that are doing the best they can under the circumstances with a president that's going to veto anything that they pass anyway. But what I do sympathize with is just this vague sort of growing sense of anger that people have. And a lot of it you can't even sort of articulate and put your finger on, but it's an accumulation of years and years and years of government doing these sorts of things, mm-hmm. and protest groups doing these sorts of things. And at a certain point, people are just going to snap back and say, enough, we've had it. And the real problem is that sometimes it triggers an overreaction in the opposite way. You start getting a French revolution instead of an American revolution. And that's what a lot of these groups and government officials need to start fearing.
Talking again with Tim Lee from the Center for Individual Freedom. Now, I want to talk to you as well about what's going on with Puerto Rico, because I know that you were invited mm-hmm. to testify before the House Committee on Natural Resources today mm-hmm. On the Puerto Rico Oversight, Management, and Economic Stability Act. So this is something that we've kind of touched on in, mm-hmm. in months past. And, you know, Tim, you know as well as I do, every day the news cycle is full of a lot of frivolous, silly stories. You know, a lot of pretty important stuff just doesn't get covered. So Puerto Rico is getting ready to declare. I mean, they can't declare bankruptcy, but there is there's a move out there in Congress that would allow the Commonwealth to declare bankruptcy to restructure all of its debt because it can't pay its bills right now. That's the problem. Puerto Rico can't pay its bills, right?
Yeah. The real problem here is, and this is a large CFIF campaign, and some people out there have probably seen some of the commercials on Fox News and other places like that. For people who don't follow these things closely and for people who aren't bankruptcy attorneys, the bottom line here is this. Puerto Rico has behaved in a way that a lot of other states in America have behaved, Illinois, California, et cetera. Now, they're not entitled to bankruptcy protection under our laws, but there has been a movement to grant them that protection and other benefits that amount to a bailout. And it actually gets even worse than that. And the reason we're particularly interested in this campaign is that it goes even beyond Chapter 9. I'll give you one example. One of the proposals going through Congress right now is to impose a stay on any legal action by bondholders. It was 18 months beforehand, and I think a revision has reduced the time a little bit, but the bottom line here is not only does it extend some bankruptcy protections to Puerto Rico that it shouldn't have, it actually goes even beyond that to what we call Super Chapter 9. And so what we're trying to do is point this out to people. And here's the real unfortunate thing. You referred a moment ago to this invitation to me to speak. I got this on Friday late afternoon. And, I mean, this is what you never get from some of the people talking about this on the other side is mm-hmm. an actual examination of the substance. So you get this invitation on a Friday, which was really too late to even come out for it. But, you know, frankly, the campaign that we have speaks for itself, and we created a response. And anybody who wants to go to our website, please check it out, because what we do is we substantively respond regarding the concerns we have about the bill and the ways in which the bill is flawed. And we point out, by the way, that we're not the only ones opposing this. The Republican Study Committee, which is the group of the most conservative members of the House of Representatives, opposes this. And on their website, at least as of the last time I checked, the leader of the Republican Study Committee was assailing this bill, this Super Chapter 9 Puerto Rico bill, saying it's unacceptable and that the Republican Study Committee opposes it. Other groups who have opposed it are everybody from the Heritage Foundation, which is obviously very conservative, to National Taxpayers Union, which is right of center but not conservative in the same way as the Heritage Foundation. NTU focuses more on fiscal issues and might be even considered a little bit more libertarian. I don't think anybody over there, we're friends with NTU, and I don't think anybody over there would object to me saying that they are of a different character of conservatism than Heritage Foundation, but they both agree that this is bad. The Weekly Standard has run pieces discussing how what a terrible idea this Super Chapter 9 Puerto Rico bill is. The Wall Street Journal's Mary Anastasia O'Grady, who writes on the Western Hemisphere in the Americas, she has said similarly critical things. And so this is hardly CFIF, and so unfortunately what you're getting is some members of the committee and some of their staffers who are saying some things that just aren't true. They accuse us of deceit. And so anybody who thinks that, even remotely, is willing to entertain that, please go to our letter. We spell out, we cite the bill itself. We don't just come back with rhetoric like those critical of us do. We actually cite the provisions of the bill. We cite the other people, conservatives, who are against this and why they're against it. And we articulate it very thoroughly. So, you know, this is obviously something that we consider very important. And it's unfortunate that I think that, you know, the committee and some people on it and some of the staffers have descended to this. But, you know, that's politics sometimes. But fortunately, there are people on the committee, other members of Congress and members of the Republican Study Committee who are on this actual House committee dealing with this that oppose it as well. And they were pretty outspoken about it today during the hearing. So that's good as well. But the bottom line is here, we're hardly alone here. We're standing alongside the Republican Study Committee, Heritage Foundation, National Taxpayers Union, 60-plus Association, and other conservatives. We're pretty united against this.
Talking again with Tim Lee with the Center for Individual Freedom. All right, Tim, listen, we are almost out of time. I appreciate you coming on the program, sir. It is good talking to you as always, and I look forward to doing this again next week. One day.
Sounds great. My column last week was entitled Harvard Law Journal Study, Fewer Guns Don't Mean Less Crime. So maybe we can discuss that next week.
Absolutely. We'll talk again soon. Tim Lee joining us here from the Center for Individual Freedom here on NRA News Cam and Company. Stephen Cruiser of PJ Media will join us on the program after a quick timeout. Stick around. We'll be back with much more NRA News Cam and Company right after this.
Speaking to our good friend John Anoni with 2 Million Bullets and Camp Compass. John, welcome back to NRA News. How are you, my friend?
I am on top of the world. How are you?
How's Allentown?
Allentown is in need of some improvement, and I guess that's why I'm there.
Amen, brother. So first, before we get in, you got some neat projects I want to talk to you about. Yeah. But tell folks, what is 2 Million Bullets and what's Camp Compass? What do you do?
2 Million Bullets is actually an orange-ribbon campaign to prioritize our children in the youth shooting sports. That as well as Camp Compass, which is a nonprofit that rewards inner-city kids with outdoor excursions, basically hunting and shooting.
How long have you been doing this?
Ooh, I've been grinding a long time, 20 years. 20 years, 22 at the camp. I've been in the classroom for another 27. So we tend to say that there is nobody walking this earth that knows kids better than I.
Yeah, I would say that's true. So let's step back for a second before we talk about your new project. How did you get into all this?
You know, it wasn't by my choice, actually. You know, sometimes this road that I'm on is a pretty lonely road because saving kids is not an easy thing, especially, you know, you might as well put devil horns on me because not only do I save them through using the gun, but I save them through killing stuff. Wow. Basically our critters, you know, so it's
God's
something
little
where,
creatures, yeah, John. What kind of person are you?
You know, according to my kids, a pretty darn good one, you know, it's something where, you know, I found this because of a need. And wanted to make sure that other kids who had the same need, you know, have that fulfilled.
Awesome. So what did that lead to first? What's the timeline?
You know, Camp Compass, you know, I actually started out of the back of my truck in 94. Just thought the books weren't cutting it and needed to reflect on my life to see what made a difference in my life. And, of course, it was shooting. And it was hunting non-traditionally, of course. You know, with that, went back into the classroom to teach to try to help and just figured out that it was something that I needed to give back.
Well, I'll tell you what, John, I've been talking to a lot of people about this. What you're doing now and been doing for 20 years couldn't be more important now because there's a lot of talk about not only about hunter numbers, and some people say they're going up, they're going down, but it's not just that. It's just attack on that lifestyle, on hunting, on the outdoor sports, on shooting, like from people on the other side who have really ramped up the rhetoric. Your devil horns, yeah. John, are growing bigger and bigger and bigger because they think you're so evil.
You're right. And you know what? You know what? If I could kind of counter that a little bit, you know what's starting to be a pretty neat role that's starting to happen is people on the other side are starting to come to me and say, you know what, I'm looking at this a little differently because you're saving our kids. Mm. And you know, it's something where it's hard to be the king of both mountains, but I can tell you that there are some people on the other mountain that are starting to climb up mine because they understand that our kids, their lives are critical. And they want to see ultimately kids win just like we do. And
absolutely.
I think we're starting to convince some people that what we do is a pretty good thing.
Awesome. All right, so let's talk about the new camp. What do you have going on? Something new.
You know what? Actually, we have a new documentary that is coming out called Camouflaging Our Differences. Pretty strong title. And mm-hmm. And I say that with excitement because I think we get a knock in the industry in regards to who the industry is, you know, who the industry is portrayed to be. And I can tell you, I walk the halls and I meet with people constantly that are of color and of non-color. And I can tell you what, the bottom line for us is kids. So that's the reason we decided to name it Camouflaging Our Differences. It may shake some people up a little bit because they might be a little uncomfortable. However, change is coming.
Sometimes, John, people need to be shaken up a little bit.
Well, and I don't do it, you know, because I get a rise out of it. I do it
No,
understood. Yeah. I do it because, you know, it's necessary for me to save kids' lives. And, you know, I could walk 30 kids through this hall today. And they would receive the same love that I would get, probably even more, because once again, our people want to see these kids win, not necessarily in a pro-gun agenda, but in life.
Right. All right, John Annone, 2 Million Bullets and Camp Compass. How do we get more information about all the great things that you're doing?
You know what? You can look me up on those sites, 2 Million Bullets, 2millionbullets.com.org, or campcompass.com or .org, and you'll find me there.
John Annone, thank you so much for what you have done and what you continue to do. And thanks for visiting us here at NRA News.
Ah, pleasure.
Thank you so much for joining us here on another edition of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. Joining us on the program right now, our friend Stephen Cruiser of PJ Media. Stephen, how are you today?
Fantastic. I'm standing in front of the PJ Media headquarters near Sepulveda Boulevard because as soon as I'm done here, I'm going back up to the studio to do an interview with our good friend Ed Morrissey about his new book.
Oh, really?
Yes.
So you have to go out onto the street to make a phone call?
Well, it's quieter in the offices, but it's a lousy signal up there.
Got it. Well, listen, I appreciate you joining us for a few minutes. Give our best to Ed. We talked with Ed right before he started off on this nationwide journey to plug his book, Going Red. Have you had a chance to read it yet?
Yeah, one of my favorite things. You know, he breaks it down more. You know, you start looking at specific counties to flip. It's easier than thinking about changing an entire state.
Yeah, so that's interesting because this is not a book that is that's an appeal to the heart or appeal to the conscience. This is not a book that is designed to get people to become a conservative, right? When Ed writes about going red, he's not. This isn't like a, trying to get somebody to join the crusade. This is about how to win elections.
It's thoughtful political analysis. It really is. And well researched.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he went on the ground to these counties that he talks about. There was one in the Washington, D.C. suburbs of Northern Virginia, Prince William County. That's one of the counties that he highlights. But you're right, it's a fantastic book. I mean, Ed is a great guy, and this is a very Ed Morrissey-esque book. This is not pounding the table, and let me tell you how it is here, people, right? I mean, this is, as you say, there's a lot of data put together in a very easy-to-read way. Ed is a great writer. He's a good communicator, and it really is. It's a fantastic book.
Yep.
Well, enjoy the interview with him. Now, in the meantime, Stephen, we've got a lot of stuff to talk about. I've got to ask you about this. So California, Governor Jerry Brown signs the $15 an hour minimum wage into law and says while he's signing this, this may not make sense economically.
Yeah, that was
I don't think they hear themselves anymore. And you would think a politician that's been on his 90th go-round, like Jerry Brown is, would be a little better in front of a camera. But and he, by the mere fact that that was able to leak out, that it was hovering at the surface of his consciousness so much, shows that it's not that it may not make sense economically. It's that it makes no sense whatsoever economically.
Right. So what's the so how do we get to this disconnect, Stephen, where the governor says, listen, this is probably actually going to hurt a lot of the people that that we say that it's going to help. But we're going to do it anyway because X. What is the benefit? If it doesn't make sense economically, what is the benefit to doing this?
Well, like with a lot of Democrat proposals, it's a feel good thing that doesn't have the numbers backing it up. But if you get to say it in front of a camera and you get to say it to the press, then you're the good guy. He's the good guy for signing the new higher mandatory minimum wage bill. Anybody who opposes it is a bad guy who wants poor children to starve. So it works into the whole media push for all of this, and you got to get back to it. It's if we did not have an uncritical media, if we had a media that was critical at all, they wouldn't be able to get away with this stuff. But they keep reporting, you know, the $15 an hour minimum wage as if it's something that is going to alleviate poverty. They're irresponsible, they're uncritical, and that's why politicians can keep getting away with doing these things, because they know they won't be challenged ever.
You know, and it's interesting. I mean, I'm looking here at a story in the Sacramento Bee by Daniel Weintraub. And again, this is the Sacramento Bee. This is not the Wall Street Journal. This is a fairly California left-leaning paper. Quote, if the goal is to pull people out of poverty, raising the minimum wage may not be the best way. May not. I mean, look, there's even this recognition among, you know, a lot of people, at least some people on the left. You've got unions who were advocating for this $15 an hour minimum wage in California who are now lobbying for an exemption for this legislation, Stephen.
And the labor unions got in on that right away. So, yeah, we want to help everyone, but, you know, maybe if we don't have to have, you know, there's so many people lobbying for exemptions. And if this goes back, you know, this is reminiscent of the Obamacare thing a few years ago where everybody wanted to, where all of the people who were supporting it so vocally then applied for exemptions. And if it's so great, why does everybody need an exemption from it? If it's so easy, if the $15 an hour minimum wage doesn't actually put a burden on anyone, and you know what? It doesn't put a burden on huge corporations. It puts a burden on any small to medium-sized business person in California who wants to keep doing business here. And California has been doing everything it can to force those people out of the state for the last 15 years.
Well, and I wonder, too, what this is going to do for jobs, let's say not in L.A. or San Francisco or coastal California, but in the Inland Empire, you know, in the Central Valley. You talk about what this is going to do to the employment costs for those small and medium-sized businesses. You know, they're not paying $10 an hour minimum wage right now. They you know, that's one thing that I guess living in that area has going for it, is that the cost of living is cheaper than it is in San Francisco or Los Angeles. How do those, not just how do those businesses, how do those communities deal with the impact of all of a sudden these skyrocketing wages?
Well, though, every time California does something to make business flee, it's generally those communities that get hit the hardest. I mean, with maybe the exception of when they forced all of the aerospace out years ago, because that hit part of L.A. really hard. But it's those communities that are, you know, the people who can already afford to do business in Santa Monica will be able to absorb this hit better. If you can afford to pay that real estate price commercially, you can take this hit better. But anybody who, you know, people go to open businesses in smaller places like the Inland Empire because it's cheaper to do so. That's what brought the business there in the first place. And then if you start alienating those businesses, because there aren't a lot of, you know, huge corporations keeping smaller cities once you get away from the metropolitan areas here afloat. So once you start alienating the people with, you know, you making the cost of business higher when the whole reason they opened a business there was because it wasn't high, it has this long-term negative impact. And every study about the higher minimum wage says this and approves it. The long-term economic impacts are horrible for smaller towns, smaller businessmen, but that, you know, that's what he's alluding to when he said this may not work. He knows it doesn't work because it's been proven time and again.
This may not work, but we're going to do it anyway because, as you say, we can make
it sound nice.
It sounds nice. Right, exactly. We say we can do something. We've done something. To that end, you know, Gavin Newsom, the lieutenant governor there in California, who's running for governor, trying to differentiate himself by being the anti-gun candidate. He's got this gun control referendum he's trying to put on the ballot. And Stephen, I'll be really honest with you. I've been honestly surprised with the breadth and the depth of opposition to these gun control proposals. I mean, you have sheriffs, you have prosecutors, you have sports shooters, you have members of the LGBT community. You've got Adam Winkler, who's not a gun owner, he's not a Second Amendment supporter. I have no idea if he's a gun owner or not. He's got a piece in the LA Times a few days ago, why Gavin Newsom's gun law won't help. Now, here's a guy who's a great quote whenever, you know, Bloomberg wants a quote about gun issues. And here's Adam Winkler saying this isn't going to help reduce violent crime.
Well, Gavin Newsom is conflating his home area of San Francisco with all of California. And the secret here is that while California may not be Arizona, it isn't the big anti-gun state that a lot of people might think it is. Because, you know, California is a huge state. It's got a couple of big cities. And beyond that, California's got a lot of rural, too. Mm-hmm. You know, got a lot of small towns. And it's never really been a vehemently anti-gun state. So he thinks he's got his finger on the pulse of the electorate in California. He's sorely mistaken, and that's why this opposition has coalesced so quickly. There were already some good grassroots groups here fighting stuff like this before, and they're just getting quicker and picking up momentum now that Newsom is trying to be so vocal about this.
So I don't want to ask you any predictions here. I know it's early, and I know that it's a crazy election year, and it's California after all. But you don't sound too shocked to see this coalition developing and forming in opposition. Do you think we'll see that continue to grow between now and Election Day?
Yeah, I think so. I think he's sorely, sorely miscalculated and has thrown too much of his credibility going forward behind this issue. Because I think once you get outside of parts of LA and parts of San Francisco, the sentiment is quite the opposite of his.
Interesting. Talking with Stephen Kruger of PJ Media. All right. One last topic for you here before we let you go, Stephen. We've talked about what's going on college campuses before, the number of protests at the Ohio State University. There was a student sit-in there in the administration building. It was a short-lived protest. It didn't get a lot of headlines at the time because the president of the Ohio State University told those who were occupying the administration building, you have until 5 o'clock in the morning. If you're here at 5 o'clock in the morning, we're arresting you. We will give you the opportunity to go to jail for your beliefs, is what he said. And none of the students took the president up on that offer, Stephen. They all vacated the premises. They all found somewhere else to be.
Isn't it somewhere an octogenarian hippie is weeping from the 60s? You know, because, you know, those 60s radicals, at least they would all get chained together and hauled off to jail every time they protested, you know? These kids today lack commitment. If you ever wanted a perfect snapshot of how weak everything on college campuses has become, it's that the protesters aren't even willing to get a perfunctory arrest booking and then thrown back out on the street thing. Like a catch and release, basically. They're not even willing to go through that anymore, when that used to be the badge of honor for a
right?
protester.
No,
that was the end game then.
You're absolutely right. Matter of fact, we just saw, I think, 400 protesters get arrested in Washington, D.C. for something or other. I couldn't tell you what it was, but you know, it is still happening. And you're right. When given that opportunity to, you know, practice civil disobedience, and again, there are consequences. There are consequences to practicing civil disobedience. There were consequences for speaking up for civil rights. There were consequences for speaking up for a speech on campus. You know, you have to be willing to put some skin in the game. And
yeah.
I think what we saw at the Ohio State is, no, this is about attention. This is about feelings. This is about, you know, a feeling empowered. But when it actually comes to push comes to shove, you know what? They don't want that. They want the benefits of protesting, but they don't want the risks of protesting.
Yeah, and they want to, I mean, it's become, I think Occupy did this a lot, too. It's become like a social gathering for them. It's a place for them.
Mm.
It's like a live online dating area, and they can get some drugs there while they're there, you know. I really don't think, I think if you press 90% of the people in a protest right now about what they're protesting about, they wouldn't know.
Yeah. They would. Well, they would think that they would know.
They would give you a talking point or two, and if you leaned on them,
right,
there would be no depth there. They wouldn't, you know, they would have a couple of talking points down and not much beyond that.
Yes, and the talking points, I think, would likely all be in academies, right? It would be really just, you know, word salads. Couldn't have much of a conversation about why you're actually there. Now, I think that you're right about that. So will we see other university presidents and officials emulate the actions of the president of the Ohio State University, you think?
One would hope, because, you know, if he does it relatively consequence-free. Now, if he comes out, you know, in this era of nonstop apologies, if he comes out and kind of apologizes for that, or if he hurt anyone's feelings, then we've got problems. Then everyone else is going to be leery. If he stands by it, is it a he or a she? I forgot. I just completely spaced on that.
It's a he.
Okay. If he stands by it, then it should strengthen the resolve of other college presidents. But if we get one of those belated so-so apologies, then it's going to mess things up.
Talking again with us, Stephen Kruiser from PJ Media. Stephen, listen, I appreciate you joining us on the program. Any truth to the rumors I'm seeing that there are Kruiser 2016 chalkings that are happening on campuses all across the country?
I would hope so, because that would be the greatest. I would do that. If that were happening, then I would disappear. I would completely let that happen, and then I'm like, that. Remember, then I would just do one of those famous disappearance things.
All right, buddy. Listen, thanks for coming on the show, sir. It's always good talking with you, and I hope we get a chance to do this again soon.
All right, thank you.
Stephen Kruiser joins from PJ Media. He's going to head back inside there on a beautiful L.A. afternoon to interview our friend Ed Morrissey from Hot Air. His new book, again, Going Red, is out. All right, now, only got about 90 seconds or so left on the program. Let me tell you what's coming up on tomorrow's show. Our friend Jim Garrity from National Review going to join us in studio. I will actually be up in the mothership, Kurt Schlichter, the author of Conservative Insurgency, and way too many columns to identify by name, will be with us on the program as well. We are continuing to keep our eyes on some of the big Second Amendment news and information out there, including what's going on, again, in Chicago, where you've got a report out by a mayoral task force, very, very critical of racism within the ranks of the Chicago Police Department, systemic racism within the Chicago Police Department. Is in essence what this mayoral task force is saying. The mayor says, well, yeah, sure, we got racism everywhere, but now it's more important to talk about moving forward. This comes at a time, again, of a great deal of disconnect and distrust between the community and the Chicago Police Department, and at a time in which violent crime is on the rise there in the Windy City. So we'll be talking about that, as well as the latest on campus carry and more. It's all right here on the next edition of NRA News Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. We'll see you then.